Okay. All right. Good morning. It's May 10th. This is the Land Use and Sustainability Committee meeting. I'm joined by my colleagues, Vice Chair Laura Dominguez and Commissioner David Richardson. Tom, do we have any housekeeping items?
Yeah, just a couple, Mr. Chair. Item number three regarding the Ocean Terrace LDR amendment has been deferred by the sponsor to the June 20th, 2023 meeting. And item number 16, which was a discussion at committee regarding the state legislation relating to maximum freeboard, has been withdrawn and won't be heard today.
Okay. Anything else? Is any of our colleagues online?
I don't see any right now, but I'll let you know
okay.
If they...
Okay. Let's confirm if you... I think you said Commissioner Fernandez might be joining, in which case I'll wait on his items a bit if he's coming in. If not, we'll proceed. Colleagues, do you have anything you want to take out of order? Otherwise, I'll just start from the top. Now, can we confirm if Commissioner Fernandez is joining us? Because a couple of these are his items, and I don't know if he wants to tee them up.
He had indicated to me the other day that he would be attending and that he may have to leave late morning, but he did tell me that he did plan to come today.
Okay. Let's give him a few. Someone confirm whether he's coming in. Vice Chair Dominguez, would you mind if we do your item first, which is number four?
Okay.
You want to? I'll call it up. Which is amendments to our city's land development regulations relating to live work units in mixed use buildings in the CD2 commercial district. Yeah, take your time. Or if Tom, you want to tee this up?
Sure, Commissioner, would you like me to go ahead and introduce this? Okay. This is an item that was referred to the City Commission on February 1st, and it has two basic components. The first component is to create a definition for residential office unit. This definition has been fine-tuned over the last couple of months, and basically it is similar to a live-work unit, but has a different way of configuring the residential uses. And the definition is specific to units that have more than 4,000 square feet and units that have less than 4,000 square feet. But generally speaking, in either case, you're going to have at least 25% of the unit being for dedicated residential components. The rest can be offices. Certainly, if they want more residential, they could do that. But the purpose is to allow for more of a hybrid type use within this unit. The other part of the ordinance would allow for residential office to be used for the 0.5 FAR bonus in the CD2 district. Currently, the 0.5 FAR bonus in the CD2 district is limited to residential units and to hotel units. This would add residential office. It would also specify in the CD2 district that when new development includes residential office units for the bonus, that they would not be able to be utilized on a short-term basis. So any leasing of those units would have to be for more than 6 months and a day. This was a dual referral to the Planning Board, and we actually have scheduled it for the May 23rd Planning Board. So if favorably endorsed by this committee, we would bring your recommendation to the Planning Board on May 23rd. The administration is supportive of the proposal, and we recommend approval.
Michael Larkin, did you want to say more?
Yes, Commissioner, Mr. Chair, with your permission, just like to make a short presentation. Go ahead, Paul.
And Mr. Chairman, our timer is not working, so I'll be using my phone today. I'm setting the clock at 5 minutes.
So, good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners Michael Larkin, 200 South Biscayne Boulevard, here representing the Arcadia Property Group. With me today is David Aaron from Arcadia and Paul Savage, my partner at my law firm. Next slide. So, as Tom Mooney just told you all, the administration's complete support of this legislation because it furthers the city goals of promoting live-work options for residents. Next slide. This is a recognized policy you see in the town center. The city recognized that live-work lifestyles are valuable and went ahead and made it a policy in the land use element. So the city already recognizes the virtue of having live-work or what we're calling residential office as a part of what we can do here in Miami Beach.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I know that we were all working together to get language so that a referendum didn't get have to be called. And now that the law changed, does that have any impact on this?
Nick, do you want to answer?
Well, we worked closely with the proponents of this amendment to ensure that the definition of live-work met within what we consider to be a residential use so that this ordinance would not require voter approval on the basis that it would be an increase in FAR. So that was before the legislature passed Senate Bill 718, but in its present form, you know, it would not require a referendum. 718 has not been signed yet by the governor.
Right.
If and when it is signed by the governor, it'll take effect on July 1.
Yeah. So I've got a number of items that have been pending. You know, I didn't know all this was coming out of Tallahassee, but, you know, mind meld. They see the housing crisis that we're having throughout the state, particularly here in Miami Beach, and I'm for one glad they took some of this action. And I think it just shows that, you know, when we are slow to act as a city, or you know, voters are recalcitrant to address a crisis in a meaningful, thoughtful way, we get preempted. And that has unintended consequences. And, you know, whether one thinks this is too broad and taking away powers from the city, and I think it does some of that. But, you know, there are consequences to our actions or lack of inactions. I've got a number of items today which I think, you know, I'd like to have a broader discussion, which is items like 15, 10, 15 and 10, which go to Vice Chair Dominguez's questions, like how does this law affect all the things that are pending before us.
And, Mr. Sharp,
and I think it does.
I'm so happy that you brought that workforce housing item. I think you all should go forward all deliberate speed on that. The housing crisis is real, and people can't afford to live here, and we need to have a more well-balanced city. We can't just be like Boca and just be for the rich.
Yep.
We have to be for everybody. And I think if you have a serious, I'm here to support that, and you have a serious discussion about promoting an increase of the max FAR in the corridors that can support it the most, like Alton, Lincoln, 41st Street, Town Center, I think you're spot on, and I think it's an amazing idea.
Yeah. My original intent was to kind of get it through land use and then the full commission to vote, to put before voters in November. I don't have to do that anymore. The state did it for me. So, it shows you that, you know, I and my colleagues are trying to address a crisis that I think, sadly, some folks in our community, for whatever reasons, NIMBYism, just won't confront, which is the lack of affordable housing in our city and the crisis this is presenting to people. I mean, to me, it's inhumane that people literally cannot afford to live here or anywhere. And so what do you do with your families? You got to uproot them, move them, tie up your rip up your family roots. It makes no sense. And I think that's where it comes from in Tallahassee, which is we have to address this affordability issue, and local municipalities can't stand up to voters and say, we have to do this. So they just take away our power. And now we're in a situation where we don't have any power to do some of this stuff anymore.
Yeah, look, our city should be open to everybody, and I think you all could embrace the legislative schedule to permit the increase by October.
Yeah. By the way, this almost happened with historic preservation because, you know, again, some municipalities, including ours, sometimes are just so hell-bent on not compromising at all. The state almost took away all of the power that we have to regulate historic districts. And you know, my guess is they're going to come back again. They've said they're going to come back again next session to tweak it. Miami Beach does not seem to be in those plans for tweaking. So unless we start getting a little bit more reasonable on some things, we're going to lose all our power.
Let me add, I share your comments. I was in Tallahassee all last week because I still have a lot of friends there. And on the historic preservation bill, which passed in the Senate and failed in the House, and I spoke directly with the speaker on it. You know, it's not by accident that the bill ended up with a carve out for St. Augustine, a carve out for Palm Beach,
and a
carve out for Key West.
Yeah.
No carve out for Miami Beach. Someone's clearly targeting because of
the sponsors from Dade County. I mean, he knows Miami Beach exists.
Right. And not only the sponsors, but let me tell you, whoever is behind this, and I think a PAC is funding, they hired Ballard Partners to work the bill. And not only did they hire Ballard Partners, they hired the ex-chief of staff for Governor DeSantis. And so at the end of the day, we were able to stop the bill this session, but it's coming back. That was strike one.
Mm-hmm.
the bill's coming back. And so I would say to anyone in the community that wants it all, people who want it all usually get nothing. And so people who think that every building has to be preserved and there's no other viewpoint, we're in a situation where we could lose it all. So if we want to protect the Art Deco district and other things, we need to start thinking about how we might position that, because that bill is not going away. And in the meantime, everybody was looking at that bill, and people weren't focused on the other bill that passed, and you can be sure the governor is going to sign that bill, and it will be law July 1st. So the question that I have, and I'm glad you raised this, is, Mr. Larkin, do we move forward with this? And I ask you, Tom, the same question, because obviously we didn't have that new law when this was done, or is by amending and putting this in our code, will it do something that would cause us more concern later, given that this new law is going to be in place? And I'd like to hear from both of you on that.
Well, let me first respond. At a minimum, you would need to amend the CD2 section to include this new provision, because what they're seeking, and I think what others are seeking, is not a residential use. Previously, they had proposed live-work, which is already a defined category, but what we concluded, and this is before the state legislation, obviously, was that live-work, by its definition, likely would have required voter approval. So a new definition of residential office use was developed in order to basically avoid the need for voter referendum. If, in fact, this legislation is signed by the governor and becomes effective on July 1, then, Nick, correct me if you think I'm wrong, then I don't even think a live-work would require voter approval.
It would likely not. I do think the amendments are still necessary for the use that the applicant is proposing to develop, but no, if we were to create, for instance, if we were to create a 0.5 FAR incentive for office development after July 1, that would likely not require a referendum.
It would just require 5 votes, right?
Correct.
Yeah. And Mr. Larkin, do you have an opinion on it?
Sure. So, you know, when the city administration concluded that a live-work unit was not a residential unit for purposes of what constitutes a mixed-use building, then we had no choice. We have to go ahead and negotiate with city administration to come up with an alternative definition that they believe fit within a residential use category. So, you know, to be that, 25% of the floor area of the building must be either hotel or residential. So when the city administration concluded that live-work unit was not residential, then we had another path forward. I'm comfortable with this path, Commissioner, and I think that we can go forward on it.
Can I ask one more? So I don't have a problem, but I'm curious, and I need to hear from both of you, whether or not does passing this affect any other project that's currently ongoing or underway?
If a project in the CD2 district decided that they wanted their 0.5 bonus to consist of residential office as opposed to, say, a hotel or a residential apartment, they could avail themselves of this. I know that there are some other projects in the Sunset Arbor area that have expressed a desire to take advantage of this, but it could potentially be applicable to other projects.
But it would be something that they could apply for, right? It's not. There's nothing out there that we know of that would roll somebody back, right?
No.
Yeah. Is that, and you share that?
Correct. And our client, David, why don't you come up here? He spoke to that developer, that other Class A office, and they are okay with this legislation.
Yes. Good morning, everyone. Good morning. David Aaron from Arcadia Property Group. Thank you all for having me here today. Yes, we're very excited about this, and we thank everybody on the dais for their support and the hard work that's been put in to navigate all the elements of this in order to bring further life and living, breathing elements to the zoning code and ensure that it stays current with the world that we live in. Documents are a little bit complicated as they can't live and breathe on their own. They need people like you to achieve that. So thank you. Yes, we've worked very closely, specifically with the community. We started with the community in terms of talking about the desire, the need for this sort of use within the CD2 bonus and the Sunset Harbor Homeowners Association. The Neighborhood Association was the first flag bearer to support us. And we've also spoken to our neighbors who are also in development process, particularly 18 Sunset, Echo Capital, led by Bradley Colmer, and his partner, who I had the pleasure of speaking to both of them as recently as this past weekend. And they are completely on board and excited about the work that we all and you all have done to help to add value to the community and to these projects.
Okay, great. Thank you.
So, Commissioner, it's your item. Do you want to move the item? I'm in support.
Oh, absolutely. And I did want to move it along. I was just curious if starting July 1st this was going to be even necessary. So, yeah.
So I'll second the item.
And Mr. Chairman, there's one caller on Zoom.
Please.
Sarah De Los Reyes.
All right. Good morning, Sarah.
Sarah, you have 2 minutes.
Yeah. Sarah, you're on.
Sarah, can you unmute yourself?
All right, got it. Can morning. You hear me now?
Yeah, yes, we hear you.
Oh, good morning, everybody. This is Sarah De Los Reyes, Santa Harbor Neighborhood Association. We have worked with David and 18 Sunset. Yes, we support the live and work environment that they're proposing. I think it's going to be very good. This is what we have. Not only we have offices here, but we also have tenants that are going to stay around and actually utilize our neighborhood restaurants and our area. So, yes, we totally support that.
All right, well, you got it.
Hello?
Yep. Thank you, Sarah. We got it. Thank you. Anything else?
Okay. No, nothing else. Thank you.
Okay, well, you've got 3-0 here.
Yes, sir. We appreciate it. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Where are we going to move this back for the...
It's planning.
This was a dual referral to the planning.
It'll come back to the City Commission for first reading in June.
I mean, the question I have for you guys, you know, given what's happened now with Tallahassee, would you modify your plans at all, you know, go for additional FAR or anything else? You don't have to answer that, but give it some thought. I mean, if it's there and it could lead to a better project, I don't know where the votes would be, but, you know, think about it.
Something to think about once the dust settles.
Yeah, I mean, you're much further down the road than most other projects. We're trying to get more workforce housing in our city. Getting another 0.5 FAR, does that mean, you know, a couple dozen more units? Something to think about.
Yes.
The other thing that the change in law does is really allows an elected body to negotiate with a developer, because now if you want a density increase, a FAR increase, and you need 5 votes, then we can press you for public benefit, and we can press you for what you want to do for the community.
I'll never do that. That would be outrageous.
Of course. Exactly. Right? You've never heard that term before, have you?
I don't know what you're talking about. Thank you very much.
Rightfully so.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You know, colleagues, I kind of mentioned a couple of my items that, you know, I've been working on, items 15 and 10. You know, now I think they may be rendered moot. Well, the discussion on live... local is not moot, but the workforce housing issue, I think, is. But I do want to have a discussion with Tom and our legal counsel about that, so we can all be briefed on, you know, their interpretation of it. We could say that for later, but I think that'll be a dialogue. So maybe we'll just chip away at a few of our agenda items, and then we'll open that up. I don't want to run out of time. Okay. Okay, we just did item 4. Commissioner Fernandez, you've got a lot on the agenda today, so if there's some things you want to hear as a priority, please let me know.
Mr. Chair, it would be great if we could get to item number 2. I'm going to be deferring item number 3. Yeah. You know, that was an item that was initiated by the Planning Board. I'm not sure the Planning Board ever properly noticed that item on an agenda, if they ever sent an e-blast, if they ever held any community meetings, how they're now requiring for other items that are going to the Planning Board from the City Commission. So if we're requiring certain process from items coming from the City Commission, I want to see also that initiatives brought to us by the planning board also follow an equal process. So for now, I would like to defer that item till I get clarity on the process that the planning board took on item number three. But item number two certainly is an item I'd like to hear in today's meeting, if possible.
Absolutely. Let's call it up. You want to introduce this for us? So this is a proposed overlay regulations for the north side of Belle Isle, which would include Century Lane and Ferry Lane, to preserve the low-scale residential character of the neighborhood. Do you want to preface it?
You want me to go ahead and tee it up? Okay.
Yes, Tom, please.
Yeah, this is an item that was originally referred last October, and it was discussed briefly at the November meeting. And recently, there has been an updated overlay ordinance that is part of your package. And we summarize the updated ordinance, and I'll go through it very quickly. It basically does three things. Number one, it removes any previously allowed conditional or accessory uses in the overlay that were non-residential. So within the overlay, and the overlay, again, would apply to properties that have a lot line on Century or Ferry Lane, would only allow apartment, townhome, and single-family dwelling. The prohibited uses in the overlay would be daycare, religious institution, private institution, schools, and commercial parking lots and garages. The lot aggregation guidelines have also been revised to allow for a maximum of three platted lots to be combined, but only for the purposes of a single-family dwelling. You couldn't aggregate more than two lots if you were proposing a townhome or an apartment. Also, if a three-lot aggregation is proposed, the maximum building height for at least one of those lots could not exceed 35 feet. And then there's certain design standards regarding separation of buildings and architectural treatment if there's a three-lot aggregation. And then lastly, we did retain the design and resiliency standards for the overlay, and those are summarized. Since this proposal was originally a dual referral, however, the proposal was updated on February 1st, and when that update was referred by the City Commission requested that the item come back to the Commission before traveling to the Planning Board. So if the Land Use Committee endorses this proposed ordinance, we can bring it back to the Commission for a C4 referral to the Planning Board.
Thank you, Tom. The main permitted uses under this amendment to the regulations would remain the residential uses.
Correct.
And we would be eliminating the other non-residential uses, such as daycares, which I believe there's a daycare there now, so there wouldn't be any more of them, or any other non-residential commercial use. Let me ask you this, because part of the reason why I'm bringing forward this ordinance is because clearly there was concern about what was perceived to be out of scale development occurring in the area, lots being bought that had, you know, one or two story homes, and now all of a sudden you have new construction that's going up to 50 stories in height. Let's say as we discussed lot aggregation, the abutting property owner, let's say a Ferry Lane, there it being the Sander Hotel, would want to acquire any lots, let's say on Ferry or in Century, for purposes of helping, you know, let's say with traffic circulation, which is a big issue. Is there a way that we could incorporate that into the lot aggregation guidelines of this ordinance?
Yeah, there was actually one of the representatives of the standard had.
Oh, sorry, I said 50 stories. I meant to say 50 feet. Yes.
One of the representatives of the standard, I think, has proposed some additional language that I've looked at, and we wouldn't have an objection to that language, and that would allow for a three-lot aggregation that could accommodate some additional circulation improvements at the standard.
But the but that lot aggregation would only be for purposes of improving traffic circulation. But they wouldn't be able then to, let's say, aggregate the lot and build something like the 50-foot height maximum. They wouldn't be able to do that because that does not contribute to traffic circulation.
Correct. The proposal, I believe, states that the three-lot aggregation could apply if it's aggregated with a non-conforming hotel, but that none of the other standards would apply, which means they wouldn't be able to do a residential structure, and they wouldn't be able to do any type of dwelling. It would basically be for circulation. And to the extent that we need to further fine-tune that to make that clear, we could certainly do that.
Yeah, I certainly would like to incorporate that as part of this ordinance, because I think, if anything, that is an added protection for this neighborhood. You are ensuring that you're not going to have another massive structure pop out of the ground there. In addition, you know, you drive by there, one of the greatest challenges there is traffic circulation. There is no space for cars to queue or to really even, you know, drop someone off while maintaining the flow of traffic. So it certainly is beneficial. I welcome feedback from my colleagues on this version of the ordinance.
I just want to make sure that I got it, because I know this one started very controversial, right? And I'm hoping it's becoming less controversial. So it sounds like we are, if we adopt this, we are eliminating all uses except for residential, with the exception of potential this next to the hotel. And then is the height for residential use staying the same?
Yes. The only caveat to that, Commissioner, would be that if somebody wants to take advantage of a three-lot aggregation, at least one of those lots would need to be at 35 feet. But if they're only going to be a two-lot aggregation, which is currently permitted, then the current height of 50 feet would remain.
And what's this, the last piece about if a lot wants to be aggregated as part of the hotel? What is that part of this? Or
that was an amendment that was proposed. I believe an email was sent out to everybody with the proposed amendment. Staff received a copy of it. And that would basically allow for a three-lot aggregation for lots that were connected to a non-conforming hotel. The only non-conforming hotel that it could be attached to would be the existing standard. And it would be for purposes of providing site circulation. And I believe the sponsor would like a little, some additional language placed in that to confirm that that's what it would be for, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
So, yeah, there's only one hotel there. So it would be up to three lots could become part of that property or aggregated, and then could they build on the property or?
Two lots along CenturyLand or Ferry Lane could be combined with the standard. And in accordance with this proposal, they would not be able to build buildings on that, but it would only be used for circulation.
Yeah, that's what I want to get some more information on. And I see Mr. Larkin, so I assume he represents somebody.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, with your permission, Michael Larkin, 200 South Biscayne Boulevard, here with Nicholas Rodriguez, representing the Standard Hotel. Nicholas is passing out to you all three documents. What the standard is proposing, if you first look at the aerial photograph, and you'll see it's called Ferry Lane and 2 Ferry Lane, they have entered into purchase contracts to purchase those properties in order to put a driveway there that will serve the parking that will then be on site. As you all know, traffic circulation in front of the standard right now is a bit of a challenge. And their valet storage lot is in Sunset Harbor, which creates additional, a lot more traffic on the Venetian. So what they're hoping to do with their proposed redesign is put on-site parking along the east wing of the hotel, the rebuilt east wing. To get there, though, they would much prefer to have their driveway go through where 1 and 2 Ferry Lane is now. Otherwise, they might have to consider demolishing a part of that beautiful front facade, which they don't want to do. So by purchasing 1 and 2 and just having a driveway go through it, they're very much able to improve traffic circulation greatly in front of their hotel and have on-site parking, which makes sense. So to accomplish this, the third document that Nick passed out to you all is, it's highlighted in yellow, and it's a new sub D. And it just says, notwithstanding the foregoing, A through C shall not apply to lots containing a non-conforming hotel use. If any lots within the overlay are combined with a lot containing a non-conforming hotel use, the foregoing aggregation shall be permitted, provided it is for the sole purpose of improving traffic circulation. So that's what we're doing here. We're not doing residential uses. There'll only be a driveway that'll now circulate through 1 and 2. So that's the purpose of asking you all for that additional language.
Yeah, let me... So thank you for the diagrams. That's helpful. So what would be on these lots marked 1 and 2? Would it be a surface driveway? Would it be part of a garage structure?
No. Just if you look at... And I appreciate the fact I'm giving this to you all right now. I'm sorry, but this has been...
It was a late-night phone call.
Yeah.
Brainstorming session we had.
If you look at the site plan, Commissioner, and you see the area that has a base green, that's where 1 and 2 is now. If you see a driveway, that's the only thing that will go through 1 and 2 is a driveway.
And what would be the flow of traffic?
It would come in from Island Avenue and go into this parking area that you see. That will be the first story of the new east wing of the Standard Hotel. It'll just come back and forth through there.
Ah, so you're proposing to put parking indoors in some structure?
Correct.
And this parking would be on the second floor?
It would be on the ground floor of the new east wing. So the driveway's at grade. The parking area will be at grade as well. And you just come in from, probably our valet will come in from Island Avenue and use these stalls. It's been a point of contention among the neighbors that there's too much traffic on the Venetian because our valet storage lot is all the way in Sunset Harbor. So this is an attempt for us to bring our valet storage lot within our property.
And then you would build above this the hotel rooms and so forth?
If you yield. You're planning to build above this lot?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
No, above. You're not.
Not above the driveway.
Okay, yeah. Above lots 1 and 2?
No.
No.
No. Okay,
those are above the existing land that you have now where the hotel, right?
Correct.
So this would just be a driveway at grade, right?
Correct.
And then take you inside where you would park the cars.
Correct.
But you're not planning to build anything above that driveway.
No, we could also, you could have a height restriction if you want. That's fine.
Or you could just say no dwelling unit shall be constructed.
That's even better.
I feel comfortable if we could add that.
Yeah, please.
And Tom, are you okay with this?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And if I may ask, because one of the restricted uses that we've incorporated into this ordinance is commercial or non-commercial parking lots. Does that conflict with this, or is that parking use ancillary to the functions of the existing non-conforming hotel?
It would be ancillary. Since they're not putting a parking lot or a garage on these two lots, it wouldn't run afoul of that.
Okay. All right.
And then the very last exception that we were looking for under the design resiliency standards, A talks about an existing structure located below BFE. You know, I think the lobby of the standard is below BFE, so we're just asking that not be included. And then D was talking about incorporating naturally landscaped areas at the ground level. As you know, the standard is basically one big garden. And our new wing is going to just be about the same footprint as the existing wing. So we're just asking that not be applied to the standard property as well.
Sure.
And that's it.
And Mr. Chair, I'm comfortable with those amendments, especially the amendment that would allow them to not only aggregate these lots 1 and 2 on the diagram that was just circulated to us, the fact that it addresses the issue that there will not be a 50-foot high tower plopping up there, and that it's going to help with the greatest challenge of this area, which is parking and traffic. And this seeks this amendment goes a long way actually in addressing that. I know that the residents of the area have had concerns about construction hours. That's not something that we can address through a land development regulation in this ordinance. Mr. Planning Director, correct me if I'm wrong.
You're correct.
And also, you know, issues like having a police or a flagman or a stricter parking enforcement, that's not something that we can address through these regulations, correct?
That's correct.
Right. But the issues that are concerning to them, which is height, traffic, parking, we are addressing it this way. And they also asked about hotels and short-term rentals, new hotels or short-term rentals. Short-term rentals are already prohibited in the area, correct?
That's correct.
And this ordinance wouldn't allow any new hotels?
No.
All right.
And normally with this item, we see residents here, and I don't see any here, so I'm assuming they're supporting it. Have we heard anything otherwise?
I haven't received any negative feedback regarding this.
Yeah, okay. So I'm going to move the item with the amendments.
Just one more question for the record, and thank you, Commissioner Richardson. If someone, let's say the nonconforming existing hotel purchases a lot, an abutting lot, with a home there, are they able to purchase that home as a luxury home rental, to use as a luxury home rental? Because that's one of the concerns that the residents communicated to me yesterday.
Under this proposal here, any assemblage associated with a lot aggregation could only be used for circulation purposes. So the hotel couldn't purchase those two lots, combine them, and then utilize that as a dwelling. So regardless of whether it's long-term, luxury, home rental, whatever it is, they wouldn't be able to do it. They could only do traffic circulation.
And to confirm, let's say they purchase some other lot, a lot that's for sale, that has a home, a newly constructed home, could that home then be purchased by the hotel and used as a luxury short-term rental?
They would not be able to use any of the homes along Century or Ferry Lane, either existing or any new home, as a short-term rental.
Okay, perfect. Just for the record, because it was one of the concerns raised by the residents. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, we have one caller on Zoom. David Sachs.
David who?
Sachs.
Okay. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, commissioners, and staff. We just want to represent the owners of 6 and 7 Ferry Lane, and we just wanted to confirm that the new construction for single-family development will largely remain unchanged, that the height will remain at 50 feet for single-family development, and the FAR will remain at 1.25.
Yes.
Just a simple yes, and I guess yes. If there's yes. No discussion, yes, I appreciate yes. That. Clearing that for the record. Thank you so much, commissioners and staff. Thank you.
Okay. Where are we at?
I move the item as amended.
Okay, Ethan.
Yeah, just want to, Ethan Wassman with Greenberg Charg, 333 Southeast 2nd Avenue, here on behalf of 7 Century Lane, Foxman Tillman LLC. Just want to express our support for this item. I want to thank the commissioner sponsor for working with us over the past several months. We support this legislation. Thank you.
Great. Okay. Pass 3-0.
Thank you.
Commissioner Fernandez, you have a number of other items. Anything else you want to take out of order?
If you wouldn't mind taking item number one,
yep.
Having to do with the LDR amendment for North Beach.
Yep, I know what this is. You want to tee it up?
I'll let Tom.
Okay, so potential LDR amendments regarding commercial district regulations for North Beach, and then this is an expansion of a previously passed ordinance. This is to include massage therapy centers. or to define them and include them, right?
Yes. And for some reason, I misplaced my committee memo, but with all the briefings, thank you. I could almost tell you offhand. As the committee will recall, when we discussed the larger issue of comprehensive use regulations in North Beach, one of the things that the committee discussed was having a separate discussion on massage therapy centers. And so what we did was we came up with some potential options for regulating massage therapy centers within the North Beach areas. And as you'll note in the memo, we basically came up with three different tiers. The first would be permitted locations. And these would be appropriate locations as an allowable use without any special approval. These would include state-certified schools for obtaining a massage therapy license, such as Educating Hands, hotels, and we also meant to say residential apartments and hotels with at least 50 rooms as an accessory use. Fitness centers, gyms, and wellness centers as a component of the main use, and state-licensed medical offices and clinics, such as physical therapy centers. The second tier would be potential locations as conditional uses, and these would include within office buildings located in a commercial district, such as a CD district, a town center district, or the town center core district, provided the massage therapy center is located above the first floor. And then also within multifamily residential buildings, apartment, hotels, or hotels with less than 50 units. So if you're under 50 units, it would be a conditional use approval. The third tier would be simply that they would be prohibited anywhere else in North Beach. So we've brought these forward for your input and discussion. If there's consensus on any of this, we could bring a draft ordinance either back to this committee, or since the larger global item was a dual referral, we could take an ordinance directly to the planning board.
And through the chair, Mr. Planning Director, what is the public need for establishing a policy like this? I've seen a lot of chatter on social media and communications going back and forth where people don't understand the necessity for this type of legislation. Could you explain the public necessity and the public benefit from this type of legislation?
Sure. Currently, massage therapy centers, which is a defined term in our code, is considered a personal service type of use. And we don't have any regulations with regard to where they can be located. And while places like Canyon Ranch and other legitimate resorts have legitimate massage therapy services, and certainly physical therapy clinics do, schools do, unfortunately, there are a number of operators that are not quite as scrupulous. And so we can't control massage therapy centers based upon who the operator is or what the company is. It's a use, and if it's allowed in the zoning district, they can do it. What this does is this sets forth regulations that will help ensure that these types of uses will be reputable and they will be utilized in a manner that they were intended to.
Have we ever had in the city of Miami Beach, and maybe the city attorney may know, or you may know, Mr. Director, a situation where a storefront, someone leasing space in our city for this type of commercial use has actually ended up being a front for human trafficking?
I believe we've had instances where these types of operations have been either closed or temporarily suspended, but I can't speak to the human trafficking. Maybe
I see our co-director coming.
Tom Curator, Assistant Director of Co-Compliance. In the past, we did. I think we shut down three of them a few years ago.
Yeah. So we know that in the past, unfortunately, this type of commercial use has been a front for human trafficking. I support any recommendation that comes out of this committee. I think it was prudent to separate it because eliminating the use altogether perhaps was not the best approach. But I think setting certain guidelines, if it's associated to a school or if it's part of a fitness center, a medical facility, it sets, you know, certain standards where it's not just someone leasing space in a strip mall setting shop that might be a cover for something else.
And Tom, this what you propose is what is administration is recommending?
Correct.
And the options are we could send it directly from here to planning. It was a dual referral?
Correct.
And then planning may recommend additional changes or?
Yeah, as part of their transmittal, they could recommend additional changes. And then when it comes back to the commission for first reading, we would have the planning board's recommendation for you.
And so it would go from the planning board back to the commission or?
Correct.
Yeah, so and so would, do we need to pass it here? Or I would just move that we refer this to the planning board and get their opinion on it and see if they have any changes. But I'm not opposed to anything I heard today.
Okay.
So I'll move that and just move it to the planning.
That's a good pickup, Commissioner Fernandez. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, let's call up item number 14. I think there's some folks in the audience. This is my item. Discuss permitting accessory dwelling units in the Palmview neighborhood. This is all teed up. This is something that the folks in the Palmview neighborhood had approached me to sponsor. As you all may know, we allow accessory dwelling units, ADUs, in some parts of our city and not in other parts. The aim here is to try to increase the affordable housing stock in our community while also helping our single-family homeowners who may have an accessory dwelling unit or are looking to build one lawfully permit and operate ADUs so that they could have tenants, which, you know, has the additional benefit of helping them afford and stay in their own homes in some cases, but then also obviously to help increase the housing stock in our city.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what we did when this was referred, we came up with a draft ordinance, and after the last meeting, we got a good email from the residents of the Palmview area, and we made some additional changes to the ordinance. And basically what the proposed ordinance would do is it would allow for ADUs that were a little bit bigger. One of the things that was identified by Palmview, and they were correct about this, is that the current ADU ordinance basically requires the main structure to be at least 2,000 square feet in order to meet the minimum ADU size. And so what we've suggested is that no longer be applicable and that the total size of the ADU could either be 400 square feet or 10% of the size of the main home, whichever is greater. So if they've got a home that's less than 4,000 square feet, you'll at least be able to get a 400 square foot ADU. There will still be a cap of 1,500 square feet, and the minimum unit size would continue to be 200 square feet as well. Also, and I think most importantly, within an ADU located on properties that are owner-occupied and located in the Palmview Historic District, the ADU would be able to be leased to a family unrelated to the family occupying the primary dwelling unit. So that would provide a lot more flexibility within the Palmview area. I think that there's someone from Palmview here that wants to address the committee. And depending upon the direction that the committee wants to go in, if the committee is comfortable with a draft ordinance in some variation, you could send this back to the full city commission for a referral to the planning board.
Stefan.
Thank you, commissioners, and thank you to the staff, too. I really want to acknowledge this special moment. This is, I think, the first time in 20-plus years that I've been in Palmview that the city is coming up with a positive change for the homeowners in the single-family homes. So we really much appreciate what you're doing now. It's really appreciated. this is all perfect. I think there's just a few details that I would like you to consider or think about. You know, one of the key things that we're looking at is, like, when we're looking at an ADU, it's a balancing act about, like, we definitely want something big enough because we know 200 could be a little bit tight. We don't want something too big because the intention is never going to be a duplex. Some of the concern or thoughts that we had was, like, are we best answering the needs for affordable housing with 400 square feet? And one other thought that we had was, like, could we possibly, 400 square feet is a studio, and could we possibly consider a small one bedroom? Could we go up to 600 and still be okay with this? I think it would be a lot more cost efficient. And I think also, like, you know, the need for, like, a one bedroom might be answering a lot more requests than a studio. We're okay with a minimum for this, but this is something definitely to consider. I think what we want to try to avoid is having the two shots that happened before where we went too small and then we had to revise it again. So it doesn't mean that it would have to be 600. It could be 400, but up to 600 might be something you might want to consider. The second consideration that we'd like you to consider is, like, right now you're asking for a proof of homestead exemption. In some cases, and we do have some cases in our neighborhood where we have some foreigners who are here on a visa. They own the home, they live there, and I don't know if it could be some accommodation so that we can prove, they can document that they live in the house without necessarily going over the homestead exemption. I don't know what staff could do with this, and I understand we definitely do not want a double renting of the main house and the ADU, but a little bit of flexibility would be appreciated there. The third thing was, like, we have some concern for some corner lots. The current text is saying that the entrance to the ADU shouldn't be visible from the street or from the right-of-way. This might be very difficult for a property that is on the corner lot. I mean, you see it either on one street or the other. So it's not a big difference. I think, you know, it's something we can work with. So these are the main thing, but we really, really appreciate this. This is exciting for us. So I hope you can consider that.
Yeah. So what's currently being proposed, 400 or up to 600, or what? What's the current language?
The draft would allow 400. It's based upon the size of the main home, but you can, regardless of the size of your home, you can have 400 square feet. Most of the homes in Palmview are well under 4,000 square feet, so they would, for all practical purposes, be capped at 400. I think what Stefan's suggesting is rather than 400, perhaps in Palmview, it could be 600. These units, regardless of the size of the main home, could be up to 600 square feet. I think that would still be within what would be considered an accessory dwelling unit because it would still be smaller than the main home.
Yeah, and what can they be two-story?
Yes.
Are most of them two-story, or do we know?
Most are one, although some are above a garage. Mm-hmm. So those are two stories.
But that would still just be one living level, if
correct,
you will, right? So, and what's the average size of the home in Palmview? You said some are as large as 4,000?
No, I think probably the average size, I would say, is 2,000, would you say?
I was going to say, yeah. 2,000, yes.
But some could be larger, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that given the size of the lots and the years of construction, I'd be surprised if you had homes that were much larger than 3,000.
That's correct.
I'm just wondering if there's a way. I'm not opposed to the 600, but if you had a really small lot. So I'm just wondering if there's a way to think through a formula, right, to say maybe 400, but if your lot size is bigger, to have a multiple or a percentage of the lot size or something to get you up to 600. But if it's a really small lot, I don't know that we'd want 600, right? That's something I'm certainly open to that. I'd like to see if we can come up with a formula. You know, maybe if the lot size is 3,000 or something, then 20% of that or 0.2 times that would be 600 or something. I don't know what the answer is, but I'm certainly open to that, but I think it could be a formula. And then I totally agree on the homestead exemption. I don't know, maybe it's just a certificate where someone certifies that they're living in the home, or they provide proof that the utilities are in their name or something. I don't know. We've dealt with that, I think, before. And on the question on the entrance, I think it's a valid point. If you have a corner lot, so maybe there could be an exception if it's a corner lot.
Just for corner lots.
For corner lots.
Yep.
So, and then what we could do today is we would send it back to the commission for referral of planning?
Correct.
So I will move it. I will move the item back to the commission. And so I would just ask that before it gets to the commission, could you guys look into this, whether or not there's a possibility of coming up with a formula?
Sure.
Between 400 and 600, and then on the homestead exemption, give some ideas. And I think I'm okay just saying there's an exception for corner lots on the drive. So I'll move that.
Yeah, just had a couple questions. Stefan, are there really small lots there?
Well, actually, they're all pretty much the same, except for some, one or two. I think they all, is it 50 by 150?
Yeah, I think they're all about 7,500 square
feet. Yes, exactly.
So I would be fine not doing the formula and moving ahead with up to 600 square feet.
Okay. Mr. Chair, if I may, there's also one thing I wanted to see about, and Tom Mooney already kind of partially answered this, is like we want to make sure that we try to do as much as we can and keep it simple for the residents. So I haven't been able to review the guidelines, but like whatever could be approved without having to go in front of the HPB and could still be approved, like for example, if it's not visible from the street or anything like this, you know, again, like it's another process getting, you know, when you're looking at a cost of a small unit, going to with a lawyer in front of the HPB, applying and all this. So I believe my main understanding was like if it's not visible from the street,
There's a couple of different thresholds, and these are under Chapter 118, Article 10. It's probably, in this particular instance, going to be less about the visibility and more about the square footage because staff, under those codified regulations, can only approve an attached addition up to a certain size, which is both a percentage of the main home as well as a cap on the square footage. So it really will depend upon the square footage. We have been able to approve some very modest additions in the historic districts before, and so we may very well be able to approve an accessory structure here, provided that no demolition of the existing home is proposed. But to the extent that other section of the code would need to be tweaked to provide more administrative authority, that's something else that you could consider.
Yeah, Tom, depending on how my colleagues feel, I mean, I'm happy to sponsor that. I mean, if you can guide us on what you would need to see amended so that, you know, a single-family homeowner doesn't have to go before the HPB because it's expensive and it's very time-consuming. If there are things we can do, you know, by code amendment, let me know what that legislation would look like and I'll sponsor it.
Do you want us to make it part of this referral that we're going to take back to the commission for referral to the planning board, or do you want to see it beforehand?
Send it before. I trust you. It's going to come back to us ultimately.
We'll anyway, right? We'll show it to you before we put it on for a
CFO. Yeah, let me look at it, but I don't know if my colleagues...
Let me ask a question, though, on that, because this is specific to one neighborhood, and I think what you would do would make it citywide, right, or no?
Well, I guess it would.
So I think you need a separate one, because I think your intention would be to make that citywide whatever you do, or no?
Well, not the intent. Well, it would only be citywide to the extent that we allow ADUs...
Exactly.
So,
yeah, it would actually be limited to single-family districts, also located in a historic district. So, there aren't many. Palm View is one of the few.
Palm View's issue will apply to the other districts where we allow it. So, yeah, it would be universal, but it would solve the same concern that you have. Can I ask you a question? In your neighborhood, how interested are they in this issue? Is this something that some folks want to implement?
Yeah, and actually what's very interesting is like we do have people who have existing structure and that are already approved for that. We have some other ones who have, like, for example, an older garage, and they would like to rehabilitate the garage.
Perfect. Good.
So this is pretty exciting. What I think is beautiful with this proposal is like you take it this way and you can be extremely creative about how you use it to your own for your own property. And even the ones that are not interested are okay with it. You know, they don't see. The main concern was like to avoid having a double rental.
Yep.
Where you have the main house rented and the back.
Yep.
Rental. That would be a mess.
Yep.
But it's very exciting.
Yeah, good. Yeah, I mean. Yeah.
Let me ask on that point. What happens if, let's say, somebody's living in their home now and they have an auxiliary, and then they decide to move out and they want to rent? So would they be able to do that after the fact or no?
No, I think it's yearly. You would have to document that you're still it's a yearly process about reconfirming that you're using the main house.
Yes.
So if the primary resident and owner moved out, then and they rented the main house, they would have to remove the tenant and not be able to rent that.
That's my understanding,
correct.
Yes.
And can I just confirm on the lot size that Commissioner Dominguez was speaking? What's the standard lot size over there, 75 by what?
50 by 150, I believe, yeah. Is the standard lot size, which is 7,500 square feet.
7,500.
And Stefan's right, with the exception of maybe a couple of homes, most of the homes, that was the original platting, and those homes are about that size.
Okay.
I think that 600 is a comfortable number. Staff would be comfortable with that as well. It's certainly clearly still accessory to the main use, and you wouldn't be able to go above that unless you had a double lot with a very, very large home on it. Most of these homes would not be able to exceed that amount.
Yeah. So I'm okay with that. If you're okay with that, I'm okay with 600 as well. So I can amend my motion. And so that would just be a recommendation if we're in agreement to send that back.
Thank you so
Sounds
much.
Good.
We
yeah,
really
thanks.
Appreciate this.
Thanks. Thanks for staying
All right, so
on top
we'll,
of this.
We'll take this ordinance as revised back to the commission for referral to the planning board. And Commissioner Arreola will get you a draft of the separate ordinance that would amend the HP regs regarding single-family homes in historic districts for accessory dwelling unit review.
Yeah, and I mean, I'll leave it to you to think through how that would have to read so that you have administrative rights. Okay. Is Commissioner Fernandez gone?
He was coming back.
Okay. We have a number of his items. Okay, let's take up one of my items since I am here. Item number nine. Who's going to present item number nine, which is to discuss requirements for EV parking and new developments?
Michael Belush from Planning is going to present. Mr. Chair, based upon the direction of the Land Use Committee, we did put together a draft ordinance that further enhances our EV requirements, and Michael will take you through what the proposed changes are.
And I'll just tee this up, colleagues. We I don't remember if it was a land use or in the full commission meeting. Just brought up the issue, you know, clearly EV market share is going up and up and up. A lot of, you know, folks are buying EVs. The issue they have is finding sufficient charging stations. It's going to become more and more of a problem for us as a city. A lot of our older buildings, you know, it's expensive if they can retrofit at all. So as to not exacerbate the problem, you know, to what extent do we want to have requirements that new developments incorporate EV charging stations as part of their development agreement and proposals? So that's why I'm bringing this up.
Thank you, and good morning, everybody. My name is Michael Belush with the Planning Department. As mentioned, this was last discussed by the committee on March 1st, and based on the discussion, we drafted an ordinance to respond to those discussions. So one of the things this does is for level two charging requires that for all uses, a minimum of 10% of the provided parking, which would apply to residential and hotel development and also standalone garages and lots, or required parking for commercial uses, shall be equipped with level two charging stations. This is an increase from the current requirement of 2%, would also apply to guest parking. What it also does is include a requirement for EV-ready spaces. So for residential uses, in addition to the 10% that's required to provide the actual charging stations, the rest of the parking spaces must be equipped with 240-volt electrical supply for the future installation of level 2 chargings in all parking spots eventually. It also has an accommodation for mechanical parking, includes a provision for where it's not feasible to provide power or a charging station for an elevated vehicle on a lift, and that instance requires a level 3 charger for every 10 mechanical parking spaces where power cannot be supplied. And it also includes a new requirement for level 3 charging for all uses, depending on the size of development. For example, for commercial development hotels, it would require two level 3 chargers once you got to a requirement of 60 or more parking spaces. Now, this would be equivalent of like a 240-seat restaurant or a 24,000-square-foot office space. We don't want to make it too onerous for a smaller project or a restaurant less than 200 seats. And this would also apply for residential uses. It would be a minimum of 60 units. That would be equivalent to about a 48,000 or 50,000 square foot project. In that case, two level 3 chargers are required for every 60 units.
So say they get level 3 chargers?
Yes, for level 3 chargers for residential, once you get to 60 units, you're required to have two level 3 chargers, and then for every additional 60, one additional level 3 charger. The thought is that most
level 3, the superchargers, yeah?
Exactly, yeah. So the thought is, since we're
requiring... Yeah, I mean, those are awesome. I mean, if it's a new development, what because I'm used to seeing the level 2s like we have in our garage, how onerous is it these days to get a level 3?
Well, that's equivalent to about 15 air conditioned central AC units. So we thought for a larger development, that's probably more likely to be used for a guest or somebody who's not there on a daily basis, because if we're providing a requirement that all spaces have level 2 charging, that's for somebody who's, you know, parked overnight and
right.
Can charge to full.
According to FPNL, you need basically a pretty big vault room to accommodate the level 3 chargers. It's a pretty major.
So a new development, it's a little more reasonable to require.
Exactly.
Okay. But are we going to have level 2s and 3s or just 3s?
No, it would require level 3 as well, but two for the first 60 units and then one for every additional 60 units.
That would be in addition to the level 2.
Right.
Got it. In addition. Okay. Yeah.
Right. Because remember,
yeah,
right now,
the level 3, you get in and out fast, which is good. Certainly for commercial, it's probably more reasonable. Level 2.
And this is just the minimum. To the extent that a development, particularly if technology evolves, wants to provide more level 3.
Sure.
Yeah.
And for example, a new building would be, to meet the minimum requirements, only 10% would actually have the level 2 chargers. And once you got more than 60 units, you would have to provide two level 3 chargers. So that, you know, could accommodate guests or people coming on a short-term basis.
And also, how'd you come up with these numbers? Is it an industry standard or?
I did it based upon, you know, right now we have a threshold for, say, conditional use approval projects over 50,000 square feet. So we have a standard in terms of what's considered, you know, a bigger impact on the neighborhood. So I thought, looking at the number of parking spaces required, a 50,000 square foot building would accommodate about 60 residential units, or for commercial uses, something that's over 200 restaurant seats or over a 24,000 square foot office space. Those numbers, you know, could fluctuate, but for example, for office users, that's something that you know, is more of a short-term basis, or for commercial uses, is definitely a short-term basis. You're not going to provide a level 2 parking for a commercial use because no one's going to be parked there for all day,
right?
Typically. So really, the more dire need for level 3 charging is for commercial uses.
I agree. Yes. Okay. Yeah.
So I think it could be reasonable to lower the requirement for level 3 for residential,
right?
Or for
that's what I was trying to get clarity on. I agree. Right. Yeah, commercial, you're in and out, whether it's lunch or whatever, so level 3 works because you turn it over in 20, 30 minutes. Residential, level 2 because it's overnight. Okay.
And we also make a requirement that if it's a commercial use, that's open to any member of the public with an EV versus...
Tom, have you seen, like, in recent development... proposals. Are most of them including EV? Are you seeing these or not so much?
Under the current code, they're required to provide a minimum
2%.
2% what?
Of the parking spaces.
2% of the parking spaces.
Yeah. Right. We're recommending changing that to 10% now.
Yeah, I said 2% is kind of low. Right.
Okay. And based upon recent data, I think around less than 5% of vehicles sold last year were EV vehicles.
Yeah, it's going up, right? Yeah. So 2%, you'll constantly be below where the market's going. So at 10%, we'll be ahead for a little while.
Right.
Okay. Eric?
And Commissioner Chair, just thinking along the lines of in multifamily units, once you hit a certain threshold of units, we typically would have guest spaces because you have the people that are living in the unit and then they're having visitors from time to time. And I think the concept of this is that we want to not only incorporate the residential units with electric, but we also want the ability to serve the guest spaces with electric because long term we think this is where it's going.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, when you're ready, we have two callers on Zoom.
Okay.
Our first caller is Johann Moore.
All right. Good morning, Johann.
Yes, good morning. Commissioners and staff, echo as always in the glitchy technology. Happy to see you all. I'm hoping my comment will be thought germane as you pursue this very specific issue. But as a resident of Flamingo Park, a neighborhood of disproportionately contributing buildings and a disproportionate lack of private parking spaces, I'd like to urge you all, as you focus on EV in the future, to consider the possibilities of contactless charging under the parking strip along the curb, which would likely need to go hand in hand with assigned parking spaces, which is something that some members of the community have thought worth pursuing. So just a thought I wanted to put in your minds. I'm sure you have thought of it. I encourage you to think of those neighborhoods that do not have the possibilities of on-site private charging. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that comment. I recall us talking about that. I mean, this item is for new developments, so separate item. But I think someone raised the issue of, you know, to what extent in our public domain, is there technology available? Can we start putting charging stations, you know, throughout different neighborhoods?
Certainly in garages.
In garages, but we're thinking more on street. Like he said, on street parking in Flamingo Park, you know, does somebody want to look into a proposal to, you know, what's the cost? Hopefully we can let the private sector pay for that. But do we want to start, you know, having some charging stations throughout various neighborhoods? The same way we used to have metered parking, you'd have these poles. They're getting smaller and smaller. They're really sleek. Some of them are really good looking. I would be very open to that.
Do you want us to look into that and get back to you on that? Because I can discuss that with Monica.
I mean, I'm happy to sponsor something like that, or if my colleagues want to own it. But I think we should look into that. Okay.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Our next caller is Matthew Galtianoff.
Good morning, Matthew. Matthew, you're on mute, Matthew?
Yes, good morning. I believe I'm unmuted now. Good morning, and thank you for bringing up this item. The premise, I think, is certainly reasonable. A couple questions, especially for the residential requirement that could be created. As the city looks, and as you as well, Mr. Chair, look to create more affordable options, not just strictly ultra-luxury housing, the construction of off-street parking is an immense expense that adds to the housing costs. So I'm concerned about the additional burden that these requirements could place on developments that are more geared towards mixed income and or full-time residents. So I get the desire to future-proof. I think it's a really good desire, but I wonder if there could be a reasonable process to waive this requirement for certain types of developments where it may be deemed a good option to do so. Thank you.
Our next caller is Andres Acion.
Good morning, Andres.
Good morning, commissioners. Thank you for looking into this. I've been trying to push developers in general to start thinking about this for a long time already. 10% is a good number, but you should really be thinking about how you're going to increase that number moving forward, because it really is not going to be enough moving forward. And I would also encourage you guys to look at all the parking garages throughout Miami Beach and sort of like have a plan and say, you know, how many level three chargers do we have scattered evenly throughout Miami Beach to offer that service? Because if you fast forward to 5 years from now, very easily you'll have 30% of cars probably new cars sold or probably be with EV components to them. So I think it's important that we could showcase that within the city of Miami Beach, saying that if you come to Miami Beach, you're going to be able to charge your cars here. It's like it's going to be needed like a gas station. So thank you for considering it.
Thank you. Okay. Colleagues, what do you want to do with this? You want to move forward, amend it, tweak it?
What's the motion on the table right now as it relates to this?
Basically, I mean, I didn't hear any amendments. I mean, except staff's workup on the, you know, requirements.
This would be to send this back to the City Commission for referral to the Planning Board.
Okay, great. And I just want to also put for the record, I love your idea of having on-street charging. When I was in Amsterdam, I remember seeing those there, taking a picture and sending it to Monica Beltran.
Would you like to sponsor it?
Well, we're working with FPL on an agreement for in our public parking lots to have a level three charging in our public parking lots, and maybe we can see if somehow we can incorporate some of that. The challenge that we've encountered is the transformers for it, and it does require ripping up and running certain infrastructure, but certainly happy to see if part of the negotiations we're doing now for the parking lots, if we can include the on-street parking for it.
Great.
Yeah.
You want to own it, but run with it so that...
Yeah, it's all teamwork. It's not one person.
I mean, I'm only here for a couple more months, and I know some people are delighted at that idea, so I want to make sure that this legislation...
Sure. Yeah, keeps on forward. Absolutely.
So on this one, Mr. Chair...
I don't think I'm going to be having dinner at Nikki Beach anytime soon, but...
On this one, do you want to show by acclamation that we'll send this to the City Commission for a referral to the Planning Board?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Are you sticking around or no? We have a couple of items. I want to make sure.
I heard this coming up, but if I have items, you guys can discuss it.
Anything? Okay. Item number five, discuss land development regulation incentives for the retention and rehabilitation of historic buildings. Commissioner Fernandez had walked out, but Tom, do you want to tee this up?
Yeah, this was referred by Commissioner Fernandez at the April 28th City Commission meeting, and we had begun to formulate some ideas prior to that, and it was done in anticipation of the potential passage of House Bill 1317 and Senate Bill 1346, which pertains to historic preservation and preempting local historic preservation. Luckily, as we discussed earlier, at least in this session, this did not move forward. But we wanted to start thinking about perhaps coming up with some incentives for retaining historic buildings throughout the city in the event that some form of this legislation comes back at some point in the future. And so there's no ordinance that's part of this. And I think from a timing standpoint, it's probably not as time sensitive as it was a couple weeks ago. But we did come up, just for purposes of discussion, with some concepts for how we could amend the code to further incentivize retaining historic buildings should there be a preemption sometime in the future. These include things such as expanding the ad valorem tax exemption program, expanding lot aggregation incentives, expanding height incentives, expanding parking requirement incentives, the use of the ground floor for neighborhood commercial uses, and then finally perhaps codifying a number of the resiliency incentives that were identified in the Bullion City document that was prepared a couple of years ago. Some other long-term incentives could even include things such as TDRs or even FAR incentives.
Yeah. The other thing I don't think I heard you mention is the item number 14 that we just talked about, accessory dwelling uses, right? To the extent mm-hmm. that, you know, a property can generate some income, that's income that can, besides pay down a mortgage, be used to rehabilitate historic buildings. Tom, you mentioned TDRs. I don't even know if we have to worry about it as much, but it's not on today's agenda. Where is TDRs, that discussion?
So the TDR discussion was actually moved out of committee and moved to the full commission, and it's actually a pending R9 discussion item. We just have not been able to get to it at the last two commission meetings.
Okay.
But it is on the commission agenda as an R9 discussion.
Okay, well, we'll make sure Mayor Gelber gets to it at the next meeting. Curious, I got to think that through, to what extent this new legislation even makes it that pressing of a priority, but we'll think that through. Okay, we have plenty of time. Item number six.
On this one, on item number five, did you want
to continue
this to the next meeting?
I don't know what Commissioner Fernandez was looking for here. I mean, I think you mentioned a bunch of good ideas. I don't know how we turn that into an action item or what he's proposing to do. I'd like to get it off our agenda and not keep discussing it.
I would say, why don't we hold it for 2 or 3 months and see what's going on with this state law and bring it back in like 3 months, unless Commissioner Fernandez wants something else. But I'm curious how the recent changes in state law are going to affect some of the things we're going to do in the city with, there's money that the state put forward for affordable workforce housing. At some point, I don't know if we have an item on that, but we need to get a briefing
on this agenda.
It's on this one. So at some point, we need to get a briefing on that, and maybe this item becomes part of that other item.
Yeah.
To see what we can do and how much flexibility. The other thing that's unclear to me is, I think there's about $700 million of state funds, but I don't know how a municipality accesses that, or if it's loans. So at some point we need a full briefing on that.
Do you want to continue this to the September meeting and pick up the discussion then?
I'm okay with it. I just want to clarify what I said. I think Commissioner Fernandez here is talking about overall historic buildings, both homes and buildings. My comment on ADUs was to single-family homes. But in light of what almost transpired in Tallahassee, I think this is an urgent matter for us to contemplate, because we're going to have to go lobby Tallahassee if we're going to hope to have any kind of control over our historic districts. And I think part of that will be, some evidence that we want to be reasonable about, how we, address issues like affordable housing while trying to preserve the character of our city, which is very much, tied to, Art Deco and MIMO, and historic districts. I think we need to show, some compromise. My personal view is I think we need to work on that set up a task force and a real proactive lobbying effort, because we came real close to losing complete control.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Tom, I think, bring it back in September, but I think we all should start working on this now as to, MDPL and folks that are spearheading our historic preservation efforts, to find out what Tallahassee's trying to accomplish and how do we come up with some compromises. Okay.
All right, I'll show that done by acclamation.
Okay. Item six, expedite the opening of the Baywalk. David.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
So where are we at?
This is a recurring item, last heard in January, and is a general status of the different segments that are remaining to complete the Baywalk. corridor. The first one I'll touch base on has to do with the three segments that are part of the general obligation bond. We have completed the first phase of our efforts, the feasibility. The purpose of this first phase was to develop design concepts and opinion of probable costs for each segment that would take into account feasibility, aesthetics, and functionality as it connects to some of the remaining segments. So now that we have completed that, we have some general ballpark estimates of what these could be. That will allow us to, through the budget process as well as planning on how we continue implementing the three segments. Each of the three are individual to the properties. We have already relationships with the property owners. We have some general concepts, and now is the time where we really get into the weeds of how they will work out and the cost. So my next step, I'm going to be discussing this with Eric. I haven't gone into the details with him on it. I have a recommendation I'm going to make to the city manager's office on how to proceed with these, potentially independently, to get these things going. But it will involve we have sufficient funds to move forward with more of the details of the design, but it will also involve refining some of the existing agreement we have with two of the properties and actually creating a new an agreement that doesn't exist with one of the properties so that we are able to lay these things out and proceed.
Do you need any action from us?
Not at this time on this one. This is just an update. Once I discuss it with the manager's office, we will probably we don't need the money during this fiscal cycle, but potentially for next fiscal cycle, we'll start programming whatever shortfalls we find.
When you say this fiscal cycle, you're talking about the one we're going into, so we don't need it for fiscal year 24.
That's right.
But we might need some for 25.
That's correct, Commissioner. Okay. The second the missing links is, of course, the segment between 1,000, 1,100, 1,200 West Avenue. The city has, as I reported previously, the city has completed our responsibilities associated with securing regulatory permits for this. The developer is aware of this. This is construction is tied to the developer's agreement for the Elton Road Tower, the 6th Street Tower. It is now in the developer's hands to construct. They have a certain time frame to construct it at this point. So I know that they're working with contractors or a contractor to secure a building permit, but we don't have any confirmation of a time frame exactly of when they plan on beginning the construction of this segment.
Okay, so I mean, this is just an update. Anything you need from us to speed things up? Anything we can do to help? Money, pressure?
On this one, I suppose, obviously.
What about the old Gumminick property that just recently got sold? You know what I'm talking about?
Southgate?
Southgate. It got sold. They had held up opening the Baywalk behind their property. It's got new owners. Can we require them to open up?
Under the DRB order, there's two thresholds that need to be met. One, the South Bay Club Baywalk has to become open and operational. And number two, there's still that outstanding issue regarding the city share of the glass rail. And
right.
So I haven't heard from the new owners as to whether or not they would be willing to open up the Baywalk earlier, but the Gumminick ownership was not willing to open it up until those two.
Right. They were not. They're an influential family. They don't own it anymore. They've got new owners that I believe are out-of-towners. Presumably they don't have the same influence. We should, you know, talk to them or urge them, to put it mildly, to open. Under the DRB order, can't we just go and ask the DRB to amend it?
I believe that since this was an order for private property, only the applicant could make an application to DRB to amend that order. I don't think the city can unilaterally file an application to amend a private property order. Nick, do you?
That's right, Tom. This was part of a private project approval. So I don't think we have authority to call someone back.
I mean, we want to open the Baywalk, and there's private Baywalk right now that's not open to the public, or, you know, it's behind private property that's not open to the public. We're trying to get it open. What can we do creatively to make that happen? With respect to the funding gap with, I think it's Mr. Galbit, who, you know, where does that stand? I mean, can we bring that to a head?
Well, you know, Hasbrock, I've suggested what we can do to help. Obviously, anything that the commission can help motivate Mr.
And that's
Galbit
a money issue, or is that a pressure on Mr. Galbit?
It's mostly motivating the developer to engage in the construction at this point. The city has done what we needed to do per the developer's
not
agreement.
A funny, I mean, we're having a budget meeting tomorrow. Is it a budget issue on that?
No, it's actually the developer's responsibility. It's written into the development agreement, and as you know, you're going to be hearing some requested modifications to that development agreement in relation to 700 Alton in the not-too-distant future. We've reiterated to them the importance of getting this done, but you're certainly going to have an opportunity to ask them directly, you know, what, if anything, is holding them up.
Okay. And I will definitely ask that question. I encourage my colleagues to do the same. That's with respect to that portion of it. If and when that happens, when that happens, then that would obligate the Southgate property to open their Baywalk, or they also need the other property?
They will be able to open. The only outstanding item, as Tom mentioned, there's a certain issue with payment or a city's contribution to that glass barrier that they constructed in the back.
With respect to that payment, do we need more money, or it's just a dispute whether we paid or how much?
Apparently, this goes back to 2012.
Yeah.
The previous members of the administration negotiated that. They came to us and said, we want our money. And we concluded we're under no obligation to give you that because it was unbudgeted. But if you're willing to open the Baywalk earlier, the city commission may consider giving you the money. And they said, no, we're not opening it earlier. So the commission said, we're not going to give you the money then. But I don't think the commission has ever agreed that they have to provide that money. Whether or not it would complicate the opening of it when the South Bay Club completes their portion of it, that's, I guess, we'll have to cross that bridge when we come
and
to it.
And where is the South Bay Club now in their finishing the Baywalk?
The South Bay Club is one of the three properties that I mentioned earlier. We have met with them, and we have a potential layout of the Baywalk, and this is the one where we're going to now engage into further design development, working on the agreement, because they're tough. You know, they have existing boat slips that have to be accommodated so they don't get landlocked. So that's the part now where we get into the weeds of this agreement and then move forward with that. It's the largest of the remaining segments other than the 1,000 to 1,200 block.
How much money are we talking about on this other one that you do you know?
I think it was just under $200,000 from what I recall, like $195,000, something like that.
Yeah. Do we have that earmarked? Was that in some budget way back when?
No, we never had it earmarked.
So we'd have to possibly appropriate it.
Correct.
All right, so let's bring that up in the budget just to have something.
And on the development agreement you mentioned with Mr. Galbit, is there any timeline in that agreement now or nothing? No.
There is, Commissioner.
There is.
It's 12 months. They have to construct it within 12 months after us providing the regulatory permits. That would expire in August of this year. We did send them a formal notification in March attesting to that we had provided the regulatory agencies last year. We haven't had a response to that.
So it's supposed to be finished?
Yes.
By this August?
Yes.
Interesting. Okay.
And the chair brought up a good point about funding and what's missing, because during my briefing, it was my understanding that this project was $12 million. The GEO bond was $5 million, so we're short $7
million. Yes, Commissioner, what the Commissioner is referring to in part of my briefing, I shared some of the high-level estimates that we had right now for these are the three first ones that I talked about, GeoMond-funded ones, we're estimating that all three of them are somewhere in the ballpark of $12 million total budget, seven for the South Bay, which is the largest, and three and two for the other smaller pieces. Of course, that funding is not required next fiscal year or 24. We have $5 million to continue with the development and design, so this would be something we would start seeing for the next round of the fiscal year for 25.
And if I could clarify just a little bit more, we've got conceptual plans that we've put together that we've shared with the property owners. We ultimately need to get them to bless those conceptual plans and say, yes, move forward with the design. Then we've got to design and permit it. The permitting process has been taking about a year, maybe a little bit longer than that, which is why I think David's saying that we don't anticipate needing the construction dollars in fiscal year 24, because the permitting is arduous.
Okay, I'm just looking for some action items. I mean, certainly going to talk to Mr. Galbert about his portion, see if we can get that ball rolling. Talk to the new property owners at Southgate. I mean, I don't know who wants to do that, to see if they can open it. At least, you know, we've increased the Baywalk if we can accomplish both of those things. And then the other one is South Bay?
Correct. So there's South Bay, there's Bay Garden Manor, and Bayview Terrace
condo. Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out things done. Like, what can we do, David? Is
really,
it more money? Are we short $7 million?
Yes, but we can certainly put it in future programming funds to keep, just to kind of put it on the radar. It's not going to help us today. We do have the funds to continue moving forward with this development. Now, that's on me now to do that. Eventually, we would have to come back to you, because we're going to have to ratify some of the existing agreements and create a new one for Bay Garden that doesn't have one. And what I'm referring to is, you know, who has riparian rights and where are the easements and things of that, you know, details of that nature. Because, like on one of them, I forget which one, an easement was granted as part of the, whether it was the DRB or the planning board order. The easement doesn't work. It's not in the right location. It's not wide enough to accomplish what needs to be done. So that'll have to be modified, and that obviously has to be in concurrence with the property owners upland. So we would be bringing back some version of
ratifying. Can we even get those things rolling now? Because everything takes time. I mean, those discussions with the property owners, to the extent they haven't started or they're stalled, can we kickstart those?
Yes, that's my plan, is to start those. Again, this first phase was, we had to do a lot of surveys. We had to do, you know, bathymetric surveys, benthic surveys. We had to, you know, do a lay of the land where we are, and those kind of things, to see where can we these things to be constructed, and how to attach them, and those kind of details. Then we develop the layout. Generally, it's going to be challenging. On one of them, for example, I was discussing with the commissioner also. One of them has maybe the Bay Garden, they have a very large sun deck in the back that's at a very, very low elevation. So when we run the Bay Walk around it, you're literally going to be several feet higher than that. So we have to work through those kind of details now that we kind of know where things are going to be laid out. The other ones are, how do we fit in the boat slips that they already own and not landlock them, and how do they make sense so that we're not building too much? Because now we have to tear down their slips and reconstruct new ones in addition to the cost of the Baywalk construction. So those are some of the challenges getting through them. We can overcome.
I think the big question is, let's move forward, because we've been talking about this for a very long time, and it sounds like everything's organized and in order, and let's move to the next step. If you need our help, let us know, because we are all very anxious to get this done.
Certainly.
What is the nature of the potential dispute on this roughly $200,000? Is it they thought we were going to pay for something? And I don't understand what that's about. Can you give me a little?
Yeah, okay. So when the Southgate brought forward a private development application for improvements to its pool deck, improvements to its building, and improvements to the north side of the property facing 10th Street,
And they received DRB approval. As part of that DRB approval, they agreed to allow the Baywalk that they were constructing to be publicly accessible during the day, like most of the other properties have. As part of the DRB discussion, they had requested that the city participate in subsidizing the cost of the glass wall that provided the security barrier between the publicly accessible Baywalk and their private pool deck. When that was before the DRB, previous members of the administration agreed to do that. However, the commission never agreed to do that, and the commission never funded that. Fast forward to, it was either 2016 or 2017, they came to the city and said, hey, we're all done. We'd like the money for this glass wall. And the city administration concluded that we were not under any obligation to provide that because it was not a budgeted expense and the DRB doesn't have the authority to impose conditions regarding city payment of funds. But the city commission at the time said we would be willing to consider, even though we're not obligated to give you that money, we would be willing to consider giving it to you if you would be willing to open the Baywalk up now as opposed to waiting for the South Bay Club to finish their Baywalk. The then owner said, no, we're not going to open up until the South Bay Club finishes their Baywalk because it's too much, in their minds, it was too much of a security issue. They didn't want to create a dead end. And so the city said, then we're not going to give you the money for the fencing. Would that still be an outstanding issue? Potentially, because technically that was a term of the order, and the owners could argue that, well, we're not going to allow access unless we're paid this money as agreed to, you know, at this point.
So you say that the previous administration, you think, sent some signals or expressed that the city would pay for this?
Correct.
Well, the fact that the city commission didn't appropriate it is, I mean, we support our administration. So, you know, I think we need to talk about this during the budget workshop because, you know, potentially we should provide that. But I would like to see it opened. So I can't see, I can see us appropriating the money and saying it's sitting right here. When you open the gate, we'll give you the money. But we'll have that discussion, I guess, tomorrow. Okay.
Mr. Chair, if you'd like, I can just wrap the last two are relatively quick, the last two segments, if you want me to wrap that up on the status. The third one is the Lincoln Bay Towers connection. That's part of the current West Avenue Phase 2 project that is going through its design and permitting and would be constructed before the end of the project timeline, which takes it through 2026. I'm not suggesting it will be completed by 2026. It could happen sometime before that. But it is part of that design build project and is being done as part of that. And the last piece is the actual Fifth Street pedestrian bridge over MacArthur. That again is also tied to the same developers agreement that we've been talking about. The development team has slipped somewhat in getting this to the Department of Transportation. Originally they were looking at a June-ish type time frame of beginning construction this year. They're now projecting potentially September. The city again also has provided what we had to provide, which is a structural peer review. We have provided that already to the developers team, and now their role is to wrap up the design and submit the formal package to the Department of Transportation and the city building department for final permitting. Pretty much it.
Yep, that's okay.
All right, so our action item for us is talk to Mr. Galbit, see where he's at with his efforts to finish the Baywalk. We'll bring it up tomorrow on the budget meeting to, you know, maybe set aside some money if that's what it's going to take and if that's what we want to do. Who wants to approach the Southgate owners, the new Southgate owners? Do we know who they are?
Maybe, Dave, I can work with you on that because I know as part of the West Avenue street improvements, we've been reaching out to the property owners.
Right. But, Tom, this one falls on the south piece of Phase 3, which we really would not be doing anything immediately at this point.
I can get with Dave on the current owners of Southgate. One of us will reach out to them.
Yeah, just say the commission and the neighborhood really wants you to open up.
And I'll pull the info regarding the previous agreement with the exact amount of money, and then that other condition of the order about connecting to the South Bay Club, so that we'll have that for tomorrow at the budget retreat.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, if I may, sorry. Tom, are we bringing this back again in 3 months, or
Do you want a status update 3 months, 6 months? What would be your pleasure?
You're not going to have an update in a month, right? Nothing new is going to happen?
Not necessarily. I mean, if it's something substantial, we can certainly discuss it, and we can bring it up. We can maybe plan it for 3 months, and if something significant happens, we can bring it back up.
Sounds good.
So we'll plan on September.
I'd like to bring the one,
yeah, if you want,
back next month, because
Southgate.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that tomorrow.
Okay.
And then
June?
Okay. I think we're going to task you or somebody to go talk to them.
Well, we were going to do that now.
Okay.
So, do you want an update on that and at the June meeting?
Yeah.
All right. So we'll plan on bringing these back in June, okay. specifically to update you on the Southgate.
Exactly.
Okay.
So it should be quick.
Mr. Chairman, we have one caller. If you'd like to.
Sure.
Okay, Matthew Galtanoff.
Okay. Good morning, Matt.
Matthew, you have 2 minutes.
Hi. Good morning, Mr. Chair. Again. Since the bridge or pedestrian bridge over Fifth Street was mentioned, I'm wondering if we can have an answer perhaps on the record regarding, it's multiple years behind the original schedule, and it's been stated that the bridge lands on the north side of Fifth Street on the tower. Is that a true statement, or does it land somewhere else? And then also on the record, perhaps, could we have an answer about all the elevated pathways that were shown on renderings as part of the project on the 500 and 600 blocks? Are they still going to be constructed? Thank you so much.
Okay.
So I missed the second part of that, but the first part of it is, yes, there will be a landing on the north side. It will include a stair on the west side of West Avenue, and it will include a ramp that lands at West and 6th at the entrance to the park.
Right, and the ramp, the purpose of the ramp was to provide proper ADA accessibility on both sides of the causeway.
Okay. Good job, Dave.
Thank you.
Item 7. Similar to item 5, this is specific to discussion regarding preservation options for existing single-family homes in Miami Beach. Tom, do you want to give us another synopsis?
Sure. This item was originally referred back in September of 2021 and has gone through a number of iterations. The last time that the item was discussed, direction was provided to come back to the committee with some potential options for incentives for retaining and preserving architecturally significant single-family homes. Those are basically homes that are not located within an historic district. Currently, under the code, there are already a number of incentives to voluntarily retain and preserve either the entire home or significant portions of the home, and these include things like lot coverage exceptions, unit size exceptions, setback exceptions. And so we come up with some potential additional options, which include the following. Height, as it would pertain to ground level additions, and you would get a little bit more height if you were in the RS3 versus the RS4 district. And then if you were in the RS1 and RS2 district, which are generally larger lots, you could potentially get slightly additional height in those districts as well. It could include for a partial three-story addition, up to 30% of the property's lot coverage, being able to accommodate up to a three-story addition. Currently, it only allows for a two-story addition, and the maximum height potentially going between 36 and 40 feet, again, if you're retaining and preserving an architecturally significant single-family home. The other exception would be for roof decks and allowable height exceptions. Currently, roof decks are very limited, And you can only accommodate up to 25% of the area of a roof. And there are minimum setbacks of 10 feet from the size of the home. The potential incentives could include allowing roof decks up to 100% of the floor below and eliminating the required setbacks from the edge of the roof. In terms of lot coverage, we're not recommending any additional incentives for lot coverage. Currently, the incentives allow you to go up to 40%. Going beyond that could result in larger homes that could affect drainage on site. So we didn't recommend any lot coverage incentives. There's also some strategic incentives. Some of these include the introduction of accessory dwelling units, and perhaps we could mirror what we're proposing for the Palm View District in a larger area of the city to also apply to any single-family lot that had an architecturally significant single-family home on it. And then homes located within historic districts being able to utilize the incentives that are existing as well as that which is proposed herein. Currently, the code does not permit homes that are located within historic districts from utilizing those incentives. And so we think that that potentially could be a good incentive. If there's consensus on any of these proposed additional incentives, we could bring these to the City Commission for a referral to the Planning Board as an ordinance amendment.
I really don't know what the sponsor wanted to do with this, so I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know if he's listening and can join us. I'm not sure which direction he wanted to go.
Maybe we could just direct staff to work with the sponsor and see if he wanted to propose some change or some ordinance or something.
Yeah. I mean, I mentioned it earlier. You know, one of the several reasons I was sponsor of the ADUs was to, you know, help preserve some of our historic homes, right? So to the extent that, you know, people have been living in a home a really, really long time and, you know, they're working on a fixed income. If they had, you know, a granny flat to lawfully allow them to rent it out to help them stay in their homes, that's one way of tackling this issue. But there are a handful of others. All right. So I think unless the item sponsor wants to keep this on,
I would just move that we close the item and direct staff to work with the item sponsor.
I'll second that, and if he wants to bring it back, then we'll bring it back.
Yeah, just work with the staff and see if he wants to bring a specific ordinance, and then we can either refer that specific ordinance back here.
Mr. Chair, we have one caller on Zoom.
Okay.
John Courtney.
Morning, John.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to call and register my support with extending the incentives to homes within local historic districts. There's a bit of a gap right now where if a neighborhood goes and takes the dramatic step of becoming a historic district, they're actually losing rights and being able to redevelop their homes less extensively than if they weren't able to take that step. So I think it's just an important thing to fix within the code, and hopefully we can keep moving this forward and get an ordinance resolution put forward. So thank you.
Thank you. Stefan.
Thank you again. Stefan Jeunesse, Palm View. John is our name is part of our neighborhood too. And one other thing he was referring to was the, I think some of the incentives was referring to the width of a lot that had to be at 60 feet wide. And what we were thinking about is like, you know, I know the at the beginning this was meant to be essentially to try to keep homes outside of a historic district, but we feel that like we're doubly impacted because we have more restriction to deal with. And so I think if we're going to make sure that all these benefit could be also available for historic houses, this would be very important to us. The second part, and I'm not sure where you at and where the sponsor is at with this, is about the discussion for the demolition fee, because I saw there was an attached addendum with this. I'm very uncomfortable, and so is our organization, about the Palmview Neighborhood Association, about the demolition fee. First of all, it seems that it would be a flat fee. So whether you have like a 1,600 square feet house, it would cost $25,000, and a mansion on Palm Island or something would be the same cost. I'm not sure it's really fair. The other concern that we have with this is, like, we're trying to be very creative about how we can save our homes. And one of the ideas that we had is, like, you know, a lot of people told us you can just raise your house, and they don't realize this could cost up to $500,000. One of the ideas that we considered is, like, how about we save the shell of the house, just the outside wall, and do something with this. Now, would we be penalized if we're trying to do this, because it would be considered that we're destroying more than 50% of the house? So this thing about the penalty is something we're very concerned about, and making sure that if there's any benefit, that we could have it in the historic district too.
I can respond on the issue of the demolition fee. We researched this, and under the Florida Building Code, we cannot impose fees in excess of the building permit fees that are required for demolition. So the city doesn't have the authority to impose an additional demolition fee.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
And I would say, on the other item, you may want to work with the potential sponsor, because we're not taking any action on this, and we're leaving it, if Commissioner Fernandez wants to bring a specific ordinance on some of this stuff, then it'll come back here.
Perfect. I will work with him and with Tom too.
Perfect.
Thank you.
So by acclamation, you want to show this as discussed and concluded with no recommendation?
The recommendation is for you to work with the sponsor to see if he wants to bring something specific, in which case
we... But you're not making a recommendation on anything. Okay.
Okay. item 8. Okay. Tom, you want to do... Let's do item 10. And let's do it in the context if I think it'll work with item 15. So item 10 is something I'd been talking about with you, my colleagues, which was an idea to potentially send to voters, you know, this November, an item in which we would ask voters to approve an increase in floor area ratio specifically for workforce housing in our city. During that time, last week, Tallahassee passed a new law which, you know, largely prohibits and eliminates voter referendum on, you know, land use issues. So I don't even know if we could do that anymore, send something to voters to increase FAR. Seems to me, my understanding so thus far of the legislation, assuming it's signed in, that FAR matters will reside at the city commission level.
Generally speaking, yes. What the new bill provides is that local governments cannot require a referendum on a land development regulation. There is still, and we're preparing an LTC to lay this out for the city commission, but there is still an exception for charters that existed as of 2011 that had a referendum process for map amendments, meaning if you were to rezone a property from, say, CD2 or CD3, we think that a referendum would likely still be required under our charter. But as to any other text amendment or land development regulation, for instance, the creation of an overlay district, which the commission has submitted to the voters in the past, incentives for the conversion of one use to another, like a hotel's to residential use, if you were to look at incentives for affordable or workforce housing, that would apply across a zoning district or in multiple zoning districts. Those are all text amendments. And under the bill that was passed by the legislature, we would be prohibited from calling a referendum on those land development regulations.
So no referendum, but then, you know, for example, you know, we have zoning laws that set FAR thresholds.
Can those be changed by the commission?
If you were to change them through a land development regulation, yes.
Right, so if something's designated 2.0, an applicant comes in and says, I'd like to develop 3.0, be a variance, just like height or anything would, right?
And well, our code right now prohibits variances on FAR, but you could, as a legislative matter, amend the maximum FAR for a zoning district or for, say, certain types of uses. Variances meaning variances are individual applications to the Board of Adjustment or the DRB or HPB to vary a requirement of the code. I think the question is, could the City Commission adopt text amendments to increase FAR?
Yeah.
And yes, you could.
Yeah, without what I'm saying is right. So you would treat the same way they come for variance on height amendments. They want to add 5 or 10 feet to permitted height. That's a variance that goes through the process. If they were to come with the same request but for FAR, saying we want to ask for an additional 0.5 FAR, it would go through the same process at the commission level.
Right, you could approve that.
Right, we have a cap of 50 feet for height. We have a cap for, say, 2.0 for FAR. An applicant would come, say, I want to go to 2.5 FAR. It would just go through the way we treat height.
Today. Correct, by ordinance, yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then what I was proposing to do via voter referendum, is that a moot point now?
If you were to propose, let's say, an FAR.
I would say to the voters, you know, we were to offer ballot language saying, hey, would you increase FAR, you know, by 1.0 specifically for workforce housing? I think that's a moot point now.
Correct. The commission could do that by ordinance, and a referendum would not be required.
Okay. So then item 10, I'm just going to withdraw.
Can I ask a question? Yeah. Let me ask a question, Nick. And go ahead, Nick. You were going to say something.
An alternative to withdrawing it would be that staff could draft an ordinance identifying certain districts or a specific incentive.
So that's a separate matter. Let me give you some thought of how I want to bring that back, because this is not even a week old. Mm-hmm. But yes, I want to toy with that, and I want my colleagues hopefully to think about, you know, maybe creating new legislation, just putting it out there that hey, in certain areas of our city where we want to see more workforce housing, we will increase FAR by, you know, 1.0 or whatever, and then you just have that as the new zoning law.
Right.
Yeah. So, assuming the governor signs this law, which I think he will, don't know the timing of it because I don't know if it's been sent over to his office yet, but it'll be before July 1st. It has to be. So, Can we do, as the chair has suggested, a kind of a global change? I think it would require 5/7 vote, right? If we change to say we want to provide some FAR incentive for workforce housing and do that in districts. If we do that, I'm assuming that we can also have individual projects come before the commission, right? That would be, if they were exactly conforming with any new ordinance, they wouldn't even need to come before the commission for anything new. But it wouldn't preclude someone coming with a different idea, right? And saying, if I do this, would you give me this sort of density, right? I mean,
correct. We get
on a one-off basis,
right?
That's right. Yeah. So, Chair, I don't know if you want to conclude the item or if you want to direct staff on this to draft something, because if we close it, then
we got to do the whole referral. Yeah,
you got to do the whole referral again.
So. Thank you. Thank you for picking up on that. I was sort of thinking like, then we got to go through this whole thing again. Love your opinion and help on this, because we're all ultimately going to have to vote for this. You know, what do we want to direct staff to work on to bring back to us?
So I would like to see. I'm assuming this is going to pass. We're not going to take any the state law. We're not going to take any action until that we see that passes. But I would like staff to work on what they would recommend would be a fair exchange of an increase in density FAR for a workforce housing project. What what you would see in terms of the number of units, what those units would look like, and that sort of thing. And also there may be within that, I don't know if we'd call it a public benefit, is if it's designated workforce housing, you know, what, how would the rentals relate to AMI and things like that. So I'd just like to see a first proposal. And so I would move, that's what I would move, yeah, is that we direct staff to come back with some ideas, some proposal. It doesn't even have to be a formal ordinance, just some ideas on what you think would be fair and reasonable. So and I would also invite you to talk with members of the public to get their ideas as well.
Yeah. Thank you for that. You know, Tom, put on your best urban planning hat, right? We just got some new tools from the state. My two cents, you know, if we're going to do, you know, FAR, I think the first place we should target will be for workforce housing. So, you know, to the extent that we want to have an increase in FAR, let's focus on workforce housing. We don't need, you know, more luxury condos. And then neighborhoods. Think about neighborhoods. We've talked about transit-oriented development, transit-oriented zones. I mean, I think my two cents is you start thinking about it there, you know, along corridors where we have or will have, you know, mass transit options. So I think start with that, you know. Anything else we're missing or not thinking about?
Now, we've actually been thinking about this since this item was referred, since the TOD item was referred. So I think we could come back to you in June with some good options.
My two cents, okay? You guys can disagree. FAR is a great tool. It can be misused. There's, you know, I don't want to freak people out, but I think we've got to think about it, right? There's nothing to stop us from becoming Sunny Isles, right? Literally, if a developer can get enough votes, they can build sky high. I would never support that. I don't think the public would. I don't think any commissioner would. So I say that because, you know, I'm going to take a very jaundiced view towards anyone asking for a dramatic increase in FAR to build a massive luxury hotel or massive luxury condominiums. That's not our urgent need as a city. Therefore, that's why I'm pushing us, let's start thinking about workforce housing as our priority. If there is going to be an increase in FAR and they can get the 5 votes, developers should know we're going to lean more towards workforce housing developments versus building, you know, another Diplomat hotel in Miami Beach or something like that, or, you know, massive luxury condos like you have in Sunny Isles. I don't think that's the priority that we want to be pursuing. I think we should be looking at workforce housing, and let's do them in neighborhoods that can accommodate them, such as where we have or will have transit-oriented development. Sound good, guys?
Yeah, I'm happy to find out more and see what the city brings back in June.
All right, so by acclamation, we'll show this continued to June 20th with this direction.
You've got some of this already.
Yeah, no, we've actually, like I said, we've been thinking about this, and I think a lot of people tend to get or become averse to increases in FAR, even for something like workforce housing, but there is a way that you can do it that is not going to result in significant degradation of traffic or level of service simply by locating this type of housing within the right areas. In fact, a lot of Miami Beach is utilized by people who already live in a dense environment and don't necessarily drive a car.
Mr. Larkin, I saw you kind of lurking your way up here. Did you want to say something? I mean, you've got clients. You know, what's your thought on this?
I think a lot of them would find this an attractive proposal because not all of our clients just want to do hotels or luxe condo towers. They are interested in workforce housing.
I mean, you've got a client. I don't want to put the cart before the horse, and you and I have not spoken about this, that are looking at micro units, right? To what extent does this change that calculus to say, okay, maybe we go from, you know, micro units are slightly bigger, but we'll take another, you know, half turn on FAR for the development?
I think it could shift them in that direction. And I just wanted to, you all can do very good things while you're still in office. And the legislative schedule is such what Tom has proposed is eminently reasonable. He comes back to you all in June. This goes up to the City Commission in June for referral to Planning Board. Planning Board gets to hear in July. It goes to you all for first reading in September, second reading in October. So you all could do amazing things while you're still in office serving out the remainder of your term. I think it would be a great capstone to the great work you all have done in the last 6 years. So just know that, and just know that, like, for instance, my jiu-jitsu coach and his wife, they live in my guest house. Why do they live there? Because I looked around the rents around South Florida. It helps them, particularly close with them. And I saw them fall into the rental trap, where more than half of their income would go toward rent, and they would never be able to escape that trap. So I said to them, rent-free, maybe we might barter from jiu-jitsu lessons, but rent-free, stay in my guest house up to 5 years, save as much money as you can so you can get out of the rental trap. You know, I'm unique in that I have a guest house to offer them, but you all will be doing basically the same by creating a block of housing with people that are like my jiu-jitsu coach and his wife, who's a speech therapist for the Miami-Dade County School District, to have a place to be on the beach to make it more balanced.
Yeah, well, thank you for that example. I mean, look, I've worked hard on these kinds of things since I got elected for that purpose, right? I mean, I don't know why it's so hard for some people to grasp, you know, how grossly unfair it is when, you know, housing is unattainable, right? You know, like you said, I mean, like you get in a rental trap. You cannot get out because you need a down payment for a house, right? And, you know, the American way for most Americans is home ownership. That's how you build your wealth, right? And if you can't get on that ladder, you really have almost no hope of building wealth. And, you know, if you just do math, you can't get anything in this entire community now for $1,500 a month rent. Oh. Okay. But let's just say you could. You know, that's about $20,000 a year after tax in rent that you're paying. Okay. How much do you have to earn in order to afford $20,000 for housing? Not even including what your car and insurance is going to cost, plus utilities and all of that. Like, basically, your whole income is geared just to living, just to have a roof over your head. Right. That just seems grossly unfair. And by the way, your rent is not deductible, but your mortgage is. I mean, our housing is so screwed up in this country, it traps people in poverty. So we didn't write those rules, but we do write rules and regulations here that can help people. Bringing down the cost of housing helps them. You bring down the cost of housing, among many ways, increasing the supply. And our hands have been tied ever since the city downzoned, you know, 20-some years ago. And, yeah, real estate prices here have zoomed. But the wealthy people are the ones who have benefited from that, and our working class has gotten poorer. They can't get on the ladder. So, you know, I think we got, in many ways, a gift from Tallahassee. I think there's going to be some unintended consequences that might be negative for our city, but we'll be vigilant on those. But going after workforce housing is one of the best things that I think we can do.
I agree. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, we have one caller on Zoom, Matthew Galtanoff.
Morning, Matthew. Afternoon now. Almost. Matthew.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. And yes, perhaps I should have come in. I didn't realize I was going to be participating so much. This is another interesting conversation, and I do want to thank you for the leadership that you've taken in trying to address the housing, we'll call them issues, that we have in the city right now. And I'm a little afraid to open up this can of worms right now, but, you know, building this along planned or existing transit corridors certainly goes hand in hand. And I know some folks have been hesitant to support, for instance, Baylink, because they're concerned that this could lead to an increase in FAR or an increase in density. But what we've seen, you know, with this item and previous items even just mentioned today, that there is a will of the body to, you know, increase floor area ratio, perhaps, whether or not it's tied to transit. But as you do look to, you know, increase the amount of workforce housing, the transportation aspect, of course, needs to be looked at as well. And we all know that car ownership is an extremely high expense. So I'm not exactly sure where I'm going here, other than that, you know, transportation access is important, especially for those who may live in workforce housing and others. And the folks that are afraid of it, a lot of times will mention the potential increase
in development, but it looks like it's happening anyway. So we might as well take the incentives that we can get. So thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm going to hop over to 15, if that's okay with you, colleagues. I don't know, Nick or Tom, you want to tee it up, but, a couple weeks back, Tallahassee passed what's called the Live Local Act, which, has, I think, potentially significant impact on our zoning laws and development. Does someone want to give us the highlights of our understanding of what this means to us?
Nick, do you want to?
Sure, I can start. So the bill is extensive, and it contains a number of changes. It also provides for funding for affordable housing, but I'm going to focus specifically on how it impacts local governments and our zoning. The bill requires municipalities to authorize multifamily and mixed-use residential as allowable uses in any area zoned for commercial, industrial, or mixed use if at least 40% of the residential units in the proposed development are affordable, and that's for a period of at least 30 years. The definition of affordable...
So before you go there, so basically, and keep me honest, we're directed, mandated, obligated to allow mixed-use developments and pretty much anything except single-family home districts?
Or multifamily. So this specifically is focused on... So we're required now to allow affordable, as it's defined in the statute, in commercial, industrial, or mixed use, which would include, for instance, the MXC district. So
Right. So that basically just leaves out single family home
and multifamily districts.
Oh, and multifamily.
Yeah. But affordable would already be
correct.
Allowed.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Right. Okay. So pretty much everywhere except that's single family, we would be obligated if somebody comes in with a mixed use project, we can't zone them out.
That's right.
Okay.
And the criteria is at least 40% of the residential units are affordable for a period of at least 30 years.
And now you're going to get into the definition of affordable.
Yeah. Okay. So affordable is defined as households earning up to 30% of the AMI, of the area median income. So because, again, the bill focused specifically on affordable.
Up to 30% of AMI?
Yeah, that can't be right.
That can't be right. Is it 130%? It's 130% of AMI.
That would make more sense.
Yeah, I mean, AMI is fairly low, so 30% is like a couple hundred bucks.
I may have a mistake in my notes.
It probably is up to 130% of AMI.
Yeah.
But, yeah, clarify that. Okay. But that's true workforce housing.
That's affordable housing. We cannot require an affordable housing developer in those districts to obtain a variance, special exception, conditional use approval. Those projects would need to be approved administratively. So
as of right, somebody comes into the MXC, for example, or we don't have many industrial zones here, or commercial district, so they say we're going to do a mixed-use project, 40% of the units will be whatever, just verify what that AMI percent is. And they have as of right to build that project.
That's right. That's right.
Subject to, because go on, because I don't think you talked about density and height.
Yes.
That's another wrinkle now.
Yes.
So we can't even impose our height restrictions or density restrictions.
It's interesting. So the law does not reference intensity, which we measure as FAR. The separate Senate Bill 718, which we discussed earlier today, would obviously permit the commission to increase FAR for these projects by ordinance and without referendum approval. But this particular, the Live Local Act, does not increase FAR for affordable housing.
Yeah, the other one does, the 718.
The other one permits us to if the commission so desires.
Right.
What it does address is density and height.
Yeah,
and
this is crazy.
As to density, the new law, the Live Local Act, prohibits us from restricting density, which we regulate as dwelling units per acre, below the highest allowed density on any property in the city where multifamily development
for a mile, right?
Is allowed. That's the height.
That's the height.
The height.
That's crazy.
So on height, We cannot restrict the height of a proposed development below the greatest height allowed for a commercial or residential development within a mile. So it kind of it creates.
So we've lost height in the city because within a mile you've got hotels and apartments that are very tall.
Right. Now, what will act to moderate how tall a developer actually builds is the size of the lot and the maximum FAR for that particular property. I don't think that anyone could get to, you know, say 200 or, you know, however many feet.
But it renders our 50-foot height restriction moot.
Essentially.
Yeah, for a mile. I mean, there's buildings that are many, many times that.
That's right. That's right. So I mentioned.
The one thing about that is it's going to decrease our agita when neighbors come up and, you know, accuse us of ruining the city because we gave 5 feet of height variance to a developer, which is, you know, why a lot of people get upset with me when I give variances for 5 or 10 feet as if the city's going to. And now the Tallahassee basically says go as high as you can within a mile.
That's right. Now, as a practical matter, there are other factors that are going to limit.
Yeah, but I mean, 5 feet is ridiculous. Right. Because that's literally what we debate half the time in land use is like, oh my God, how are you going to give that guy 5 more feet as if that's going to ruin the city? Tallahassee just basically said if there's a taller building within a mile, that's your limit. So, you know, I've spent 8 years getting the wrath of the community for no reason. The next commissioner doesn't have to deal with that. A lot easier job. That's literally why people get upset. Like,
you're right.
Yeah.
So there are a couple other changes as to zoning. One I mentioned, which is that qualifying projects must be approved administratively. So that appears to supersede our DRB and HPB review to an extent, but only for projects that are qualifying in as affordable in commercial or mixed-use districts. We're looking internally at whether planning could administratively still apply the staff-level design review or certificate of appropriateness criteria. I believe staff could for any projects that we could no longer require board review for, but we'll have to look at that more closely. As to parking, it's interesting. The language in the bill is actually aspirational and only requires the city to consider reducing parking requirements for proposed affordable developments that are within a half mile of a major transit stop. So the bill didn't really preempt us as to parking. It merely requires that the city consider reducing parking for affordable projects within a half mile of a major transit stop.
So what's your understanding there? So our parking requirements would still be in effect?
Yes, unless the city wanted to change or reduce the parking requirements.
Now, that said, I think we already have incentives for. Do we have parking incentives for affordable and workforce?
Workforce and affordable housing have reduced parking requirements already. I think it's one space per unit. In some districts, it's even less than that.
And then a couple other changes I would highlight are the bill requires the city to maintain an inventory and regularly update an inventory of city-owned properties that could be appropriate for affordable housing on our website. The city would also be required to maintain on our website a process for a policy for expedited building permit and development approval review for qualifying projects, which could be, you know, expediting building permit reviews, anything associated with the building permit process.
So that's required of the city?
Yes, we would need to have a policy on our website.
To have an expedited permitting process or just to put it on the website of what a process is?
The bill gives us flexibility to determine what that process is, but we are required to have one.
Yeah. So this bill couldn't have been any better than if I wrote it. I mean, these are all things that I've been fighting for 8 years. It's common sense, right? I mean, it's like, so this is why you get preempted, because every municipality gets stuck in this, where you just get NIMBYs coming into City Hall, packing City Hall, the same 100 people shouting us down to do things that
the community needs, that are sensible, that any right-thinking person would do, because local commissions, whatever, don't have the fortitude to say no. We give in and we can't get anything done. The city gets crippled. Housing becomes less affordable. People suffer. The state saw, okay, we're going to have to take the power away and preempt them. So, you know, there's good in that, but there's also bad. Now we've got a lot less control because we got too greedy, too piggish. And it's going to happen again on historic preservation unless we get smart.
I agree.
Yeah. There are a couple other things if you want I can highlight.
Going.
Okay, yeah, there are three new ad valorem property tax exemptions. One is an exemption for land owned by a nonprofit that is leased for a minimum of 99 years for the purpose of providing affordable housing.
No taxes? No taxes would be paid?
It's a significant ad valorem tax, property tax exemption.
If a nonprofit owns it?
Correct.
I see a big loophole there potentially because, I mean, people open nonprofits that are not really nonprofits, but okay.
There's another for rent-restricted units within newly constructed or substantially rehabilitated developments that set aside at least 70 units for affordable housing for households earning 120% AMI or less.
And they actually designated 70 units.
That's what they designated for purposes of the ad valorem exemption for this, yeah. And then lastly, the bill authorizes the city to adopt an ordinance offering an ad valorem tax exemption to property owners who dedicate units for affordable housing for households earning 60% of AMI or less.
Yeah. Interesting.
And then just the last two, the bill's very extensive, but the last two things I would highlight are the bill preempts local governments from enacting rent control regulations, which currently could only be imposed for limited periods of time and upon
they
a finding of an
rent
emergency.
Controls.
Right.
Good.
So now it's prohibited altogether. And then and then the last point is that the bill provides a number of new grant funding opportunities for qualifying projects.
Oh, I didn't focus on the ad valorem tax exemption. That's mm-hmm. Very strong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's the last one again, Nick?
That the bill creates a number of grant funding opportunities, of state funding opportunities for qualifying projects.
Oh, I mean, I'm just thinking all of it. Go ahead, please.
No, I want some more on that. So what's the easiest way? Do you guys want to brief me, just come to me, schedule an appointment on this last piece, this grant? Are there a lot of different options?
We can work with the administration. Marsha, I don't know if you are familiar with that particular component. There are a number of different appropriations in the bill.
Can you give
the
us
bill.
A little bit of that, Marsha? Good morning.
Good
afternoon.
Morning, commissioners. I can give you the skinny. So there is a number of projects, grant opportunities available through the Florida Housing Finance Corporation. It provides $150 million annually to the SAIL program, which stands for State Apartment Incentive Loan Program. And so that's $150 million. It provides for a $5,000 refund for sales tax on building materials, anything funded through the Florida Housing Finance Corporation. It creates a new tax donation program for payments that fund the SAIL program. It codifies the Florida Hometown Heroes Down Payment Assistance Program.
Is that for municipalities or individuals? Do you know? Don't worry,
it also has $100 million, non-recurring funds to the general fund to implement the Hometown Heroes program, $252 million to the local government housing trust fund for SHIP, in which we are eligible for, $150 million to the state housing trust fund for SAIL, $109 million, again, for SAIL. And so this one seems to be this is $100 million non-recurring general fund to implement a competitive loan to alleviate inflation-related costs for the Florida Housing corporation.
Okay.
So I think that the one that we should focus on are those SHIP dollars, because those are dollars that we get as a municipality.
So I don't know what you want to do with this, but I would love if they would come back next month and on this last piece tell us which of the dollars they think that we could potentially as a municipality benefit from. And Marcia, do you think you'd have time before next month, you or staff or somebody else or housing, maybe Alba, to come back and on each one of those, come back and tell us which one of those you think that there may be potential funding sources for? Because I think some of those, I don't know if they're grants, I don't know if they're lower rate loans, I don't know if they have to be paid back, but you know, I'm curious about what funds may be available for workforce housing or affordable housing.
I will do, and I'll work with Nick to get that.
Can we do that?
Clarify.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I mean, look,
just on that piece,
I think a lot of good can come from this. It's exciting. I'm just thinking with senior housing, for example. You know, we've now got mechanisms. And the last part you had mentioned, Nick, about what was it, 60% of AMI? For tax exemption purposes?
If that's right.
If a development is going to be built at 60% AMI, the property would be exempt from ad valorem taxes for 30 years, I think you said?
I can look at the term of the exemption, but that we actually, the state gave us the authority to adopt an ordinance providing for that exemption.
Yeah, so I mean, like that's your senior housing. So, you know, if a developer comes and they want to build, you know, maybe whatever, a luxury housing or hotel housing, you know, we could make it as a requirement, I'm just, you know, thinking aloud, you know, senior housing as a separate component of that overall development, that would be exempted from taxes. There's plenty of incentives for that developer to do that. He or she would want us to increase FAR, for example. Like, okay, if you want FAR, you're going to have to build some senior housing or workforce housing. So, I think there's some interesting
trade-offs. And the other is, you know, we just had this presentation at the last meeting about the Byron Carlisle with or without an option. And the mayor said, you know, we should look at the financial models and see which one, you know, if the workforce housing could be paid for. But some of these funds we may be able to get some additional grant money. We were on that project, we're already starting with $30 million. But we may be able to get some grant money for a project like that. So that's why I would like to know.
I wrote it down here. So like two projects that come to mind right away, because they're, you know, getting closer possibly to having something, would be the Byron Carlisle, for sure. You know, I think we've all talked about that being a workforce housing project. With all the new tools we have, I think we can make that very interesting, you know, financially viable project for a developer to build that workforce housing for artists, for example. The other one is the Barclays. Where are we on the Barclays? Do you know? You know, I know we went out for, you know, requests for proposals and appraisals and stuff like that, but
we requested proposals. We've received one proposal, and it's
So stop there. I didn't know that. So we, okay. I'm gonna editorialize if you guys humor me. This is exactly why I pushed for the approach that I did on the Nikki Beach site, because when we go out for proposals, we get one answer, and then that's, you know, if it's not acceptable, we have to go back and do it again and again. The approach I took accomplished what I wanted to accomplish, which is create a lot of attention, create a lot of controversy. Now everybody knows about it. Now everyone's going to bid. So mission accomplished there. Because the problem is the city, for whatever reason, I don't know why, we send out these RFPs and we get one proposal. Now, the Barclays is a gorgeous property in a great district, which is across from the convention center. Why on earth are we getting one proposal? I don't know the answer. I just know from 8 years of experience, this is what typically happens when we do RFPs. We just get one proposal. And I don't know if it's any good, but if it's not good, we're back to square one. This is why I pushed us to go the route we did on the Nikki Beach project. Now everybody knows about it. Now everyone's bidding on it. Everyone's interested. Okay.
So you probably know on that, you know, agenda's printed.
Yeah.
I'm bringing an item
to go to RFP. But now we have everybody interested.
People now know about it.
So the Ritz, Four Seasons, whoever's out there knows about it because it's in the paper every day.
That Washington Avenue project.
Which one?
You were the sponsor,
13th and Washington.
I don't know where that stands. I think Mr. Larkin.
No, Collins.
No, it was the urban project.
Yeah, I think Mr. Larkin was possibly going to think about it again, given all this stuff that's happened.
Right.
The one with the micro units.
So when are you going to bring, we got one.
But now they don't have to.
We got one offer. Is that coming back for presentation, or you guys are evaluating that now? Or
anyway, where I was going with the Barclays is, you know, now that you have all these new tools, what would those proposals look like? You know, I mean, you could put this in a nonprofit, not have to pay taxes, make it for, you know, whether it's workforce housing, senior housing. We already have unused FAR there. We can increase that FAR, sell that off, use that money to, you know, restore the Barclay. But anyway, sorry, I cut you off. Where are we with the Barclay?
So we are currently evaluating the proposal, and it's probably going to come back to you in June.
But I mean, yeah, I mean, it is a beautiful piece of property in a great neighborhood. And we have said we're open to every idea. We got one proposal.
Right.
In a hot real estate market. I don't understand why this happens to our city. I just know that it does. And so when we take unconventional methods like we did with the One Ocean Drive project where Nikki Beach is currently at, it's done with a view, and I've said it multiple times, there's a purpose, there's a method to that madness. It's to try to create a lot of attention so that people will respond when we go out to RFP. Simple as that. Now, I don't know if we might have to do something similar with the Barclay. We may have to say, oh, we're going to sell it, freak everybody out, gets lots of attention and media attention. Then all the developers are like, oh, I didn't even know there was an RFP. I'd love to take a look at it. It's just dealing with reality.
I misspoke at the beginning. The threshold for qualifying affordable housing projects is 120% of AMI.
Yeah, we knew. We were paying attention. Okay. This was a discussion. We got briefed. Anything you guys want to do with this?
I think, Commissioner Richardson, you wanted to continue to June 20th, so more information regarding the funds that Marshall was talking about.
On that one item, just bring it back, and Marcia, you and staff can work with line by one by one by one. Just go through those funding opportunities and tell us which ones would be applicable to our city government or to a project built in. Maybe the funds are available to private entities as well, but I'm just curious what we could do. And it may be that because we do have the Barclay and the Byron Carl, it may be that with the Barclay we want to put out another R. I'm curious to see what's been offered, but it may be now that all these changes in state law have occurred, we may want to let people know that there are different opportunities now.
Can I ask about the ballet, the Servitas project?
We're going to talk about that tomorrow.
We are?
So, yeah, because there have been some glitches on that, and so I want to present that to the entire commission tomorrow about where we are.
I mean, to the extent, I'll wait for tomorrow, but to the extent that there's some, you know, funding shortages, right. Okay, well, what now can we do to plug that gap? Okay, good to hear.
The other thing is, just let's not forget that on the southwest corner of that property at the Barclay, people have said there's a big enough footprint to do a new building there. Could do a building there to generate cash to restore the other, the historic building. So,
Yeah, I'm curious to see, how this is going to play out. But, colleagues, there's lots of stuff out there that either got shelved or was deemed, uneconomical to do under old legislation. Under the current legislation, can some of those things be resurrected, particularly ones that would be for workforce housing? I mean, I think if you look at 41st Street, some of the master plan ideas that we had before, what would those look like now under the new guidelines? Okay.
I see Mr. Chairman Marcella Rubio from staff has her hand up.
Oh, great.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Rubio from the city services. The city receives an allocation from SHIP from the Florida Housing Finance Corporation. We've received it for several years, with the exception of 2020 during the pandemic, we did not receive funds, but we are planning on working on recommendations for this year's allocation, which is estimated between $610,000 and $612,000. We are pending confirmation from the state on the final amount, and the disbursement would most likely be sometime in July. So we are planning on working on recommendations, but we will most certainly work with Marsha and come up with any other alternative recommendations based on today's directive.
Great.
Okay, we've got a few more minutes to finish up. I have items 8, 11, 12, and 13.
Think we can get rid of 12 and 13 today? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, they've been sitting around. I know 13 we keep deferring because she's not here to present. You want to try to tackle them? I mean, 13, it's been on the agenda two or three times now. We have a three-strike policy.
Yeah, it was first referred, Mr. Chair, on November 16th, and it's been on every agenda since then. The referral is specific to possible amendments to the fencing requirements for vacant lots and abandoned properties, and staff has come up with some potential ideas that we noted in the analysis. We haven't heard from the sponsor as to whether or not the sponsor agrees with this, but we did provide some potential recommendations.
I mean, I'd like to resolve this because it's been lingering for a while. Colleagues, what do you want to do with this? I mean, do we keep it one more time and ask her to present?
If the staff already gave their recommendations, can we move that to the commission with the staff's recommendations?
Sure. The committee can certainly recommend that the commission consider this because these would require an LDR amendment. So you could recommend that the commission consider referring an ordinance to the planning board.
What are the recommendations?
Yeah,
can we just
through?
Go through those?
Yeah, there are two. They're very basic. The main thrust of the recommendation from the sponsor is to look at better aesthetics for fencing. And some of the things that we've suggested to enhance aesthetics on vacant lots and lots with abandoned buildings are the following. One, to require an aluminum picket fence along all sides of the property, as this would ensure a higher caliber of aesthetics when viewed from neighboring properties. And number two, to incorporate minimum landscape requirements for vacant lots and lots with abandoned buildings. This could include things like elevating the entire site to current grade, minimum facade requirements for the areas of the property that do not contain a building, and minimum requirements for hedges and smaller plant material to make sure that there would still be visibility into the site for public safety purposes.
So it would be the plan would be to sod the area. What about use of other foliage? And I mean,
yeah,
this is next to the beach, potentially, right? So you might want to use seagrass or something.
Correct.
Like that.
And when we say sod, we mean things like salt tolerant sod. It could be things like bahia grass. It could be things like St. Augustine. And it could be other types of salt-tolerant material. The thing we wanted to make sure is that material wasn't put up that would not permit visual inspection of the property, because we don't want it to become a dumping ground, or we don't want it to become a haven for nefarious activities. The police do need to see into the lot, but perhaps along the perimeter, some small plant materials or hedges.
So the recommendation would be to move it back to the commission and then do a referral to the planning board?
Correct.
Is that what you want to do? I'll second that motion. So, yeah. I think I would just like, John, I would just like it that if you could clarify where you say minimum sod requirements for all areas of the property, I would say minimum sod or other planting or something like that.
Okay.
Where there's more flexibility on what you can do, because sod may not be the best thing to do on some properties.
Mr. Chairman, we have two callers.
Okay, great.
Johan Moore, you have 2 minutes.
All right. Afternoon now, Johan.
Yes, good afternoon. As a resident of a block, 700 block of Jefferson Avenue, that has four vacant properties, one of which is an ex-CDC property, which remains seemingly untouched by the nuisances that occur around and in and on and under, namely in the crawl space, of at least one of the three Exusora properties. It was unclear to me whether this legislation referred, in fact, to lots that are empty or lots that have buildings on them that are not in any stage of renovation or reconstruction. I hope it applies to those lots where there are vacant buildings that are not being renovated. Those three buildings, and I want to thank Commissioner Dominguez for acknowledging the community's concerns about this, have attracted repeated nuisance uses. A lady apparently was meeting her client on one of the catwalks recently. People were sleeping behind one of the buildings. People have broken into the crawl spaces underneath. We're afraid of fires happening. This legislation would be really important to protect the neighborhood while the owners dither with their attempt at getting $11 million for three Sora properties. So thank you very much.
Our next caller is Tai Chi.
Good morning. Are you on mute?
Tai Chi, if you're on mute, can you unmute yourself?
Okay. Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, we hear you now.
You have 2 minutes.
Afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm a neighbor also of Johan. And then the three buildings the Azores sold for $7 million, now they put it back to sell for $11 million. What I think the city should reinforce, enforced by an ordinance, legislation, whatever, those owners should fence those properties, because those properties open are just like a welcome to prostitutes, drug dealers, squatters, and camping. We have been calling the police I don't know how many times in the past year. So I think this legislation ordinance should be enforced to the owners, demanding from them fence the building until they whatever decided they want to do with their property. But the city basically done nothing. We don't want another Deauville here next to us, because one brings another and another brings another, and then troubles began for us, the neighbors. We already lived with this favela here for decades and decades and decades. We clean up the block. Now I think the city should do that part with a new ordinance, not just for this building, many other buildings. We have a building here on 7 Euclid. They already fenced, they already start renovations. So problem solved. Was another favela gone. Now, these owners decide to make more money or move money, whatever they want to do, and the property is still open. No, that's not good for us. So it's up to the city to take action now, not just this building, any building. All these millionaire investors, okay, you want to buy a property? When are you going to do a renovation? We wanted this property to be fenced by such a date, otherwise you're going to be fined in a few thousand dollars. That would be a good option.
Okay. Any other callers?
No other callers.
Okay. Okay, so we're going to refer this to the full commission with staff recommendation.
Yeah, what I'm going to do is I'll confirm that Commissioner Rosen Gonzalez will still be the sponsor for it. Assuming she is, then we'll bring the ordinance to the city commission for referral to the planning board. And Mr. Chair, item number 12 was very similar to this item in terms of the topic, and actually our recommendations in that memo were identical to the recommendations we made in item 13, but it's a different sponsor.
So I'll move, then we close item 12 if it's the same. Okay. And if that sponsor is in agreement with the one with Commissioner Rosen Gonzalez, he can just be a co-sponsor.
Okay.
I hope that's okay with him. That way we can close out one more item.
Sounds good. Okay. Let's take up item number 11. And I'm looking at this, and I'm wondering whether the new legislation we just talked about impacts us in any way. I'll tee it up. Discuss off-street parking regulations for districts with reduced parking requirements, and discuss potential amendments to the land development regulations to ensure that adequate parking remains available to the public.
So, Mr. Chair, this is an item that was, I believe, intended by the sponsor to be more of a global discussion about parking in the city, including current off-street parking requirements, And one of the concerns expressed was when, if and when, what are now existing public parking garages should ever come offline, what the strategies would be to replace those spaces. For instance, the Ballet Valet Garage at 7th Street, there's the possibility that Goldman Properties may exercise its right under the development agreement with the city, where the city purchased air rights for 30 years, where they could buy that back from the city in 2024, and they've indicated that they may be doing that. And then the other part of the memo is an update on the parking master plan, which has, we've currently, pursuant to the RFQ, we're working with Walter Walker Parking Consultants, and a contract award is pending finalization of insurance requirements. So we're expecting that we will be embarking on a parking master plan, which would update both current and future parking demand. There's no specific recommendations from the administration on this. This was
so
more
what do we do with this? I mean, do we conclude it or we send it back to the full commission? I mean, this was a discussion item, so we discussed it.
Yeah, I would conclude it. We also have a parking item in finance that we're discussing some, and it's very broad, so we could also discuss it. But I would conclude this item.
Okay. Our last item is number 8. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. We're going to get done on time. What is this? This is to discuss potential criteria to address noise associated with CUP, conditional use permit applications. What are we doing with this?
So this was referred quite some time ago. It was actually referred in December of 2021. And the committee has had a couple of discussions on this. The Flamingo Park Neighborhood Association sent a rezo to the city. We updated what the city's responses were to that resolution, and the last time that the committee discussed this was September 28th of last year, 2022. At that meeting, the sponsor requested that it be continued to further the discussion, but the item hasn't come up since then. And so I'm not sure what else the item sponsor wants to discuss with regard to this item.
Yeah, that's my question. This goes back to...
When was this first referred?
Last year. I mean, I'm looking at the...
2021.
2021, more, yeah. December 8th, 2021. Yeah. And then if you look at the legislative history, it's had a number of deferrals with no discussion. That's why I'm not really sure...
I would just move to conclude this item, and then since it's old, and if he wants to bring something back more specific, then we can just do another referral more, because it's been here
a long time.
Yeah. So, and
I'm looking at one, two, three, four.
I'm sure he'll be fine with that.
Four or five deferrals, maybe more, maybe 8 deferrals, if I'm counting correctly. So. Okay, we'll just conclude it.
Yep.
Okay.
Unanimously.
All right, well, 12:30. Look at that. We're done on time. All right, colleagues, enjoy the rest of your day. I will see you tomorrow at our budget retreat.
Yes.